Good morning, and welcome to the June 15th, 2020 meeting of the Chelan County Public Utility District Commission. I'd like to thank everyone who's calling in and on the phone as well as on Skype this morning. In the spirit of social distancing due to the COVID-19 virus, today's meeting will be conducted by telephone. Members of the public that may be on the phone and are encouraged to make comment and ask questions. If you do wish to speak, please state your name, your address for the record, and please, if you'd be kind enough to limit your comments to 3 minutes so that others can also have time to speak. I will open our phone lines for such comments later in the session. This morning's meeting is a study session. The business session will start today at 1 o'clock. Today, as we have all five commissioners on the phone, General Manager Steve Wright, General Counsel Eric Walquist, and Rebecca Garfin, Clerk of the Board, are all in the boardroom. If you'd please join me at this time for a Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the Republic
for which it
stands, one nation under God, indivisible,
liberty and justice for all.
Thank you for that. At this time, we're going to move on to an agenda. Any item on the consent agenda is subject to transfer to the regular agenda upon request of any commission member. Do I hear any such requests?
Mr. President, Randy Smith here. Based on recommendations from management, I would like to suggest regular agenda items 12 and 13 be moved to the consent agenda.
So items 12 and 13 have been requested to move to the consent agenda. Do we have a second?
I'll second that. Steve McKenna.
So it's been moved and seconded. Any discussion? Hearing no discussion, all those in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. Those opposed, say nay, and the ayes have it. At this time, I'd like to, it's my pleasure, actually, to move on. Steve, would you present CPO winners, please?
I'd like to do this in two groups. So first of all, we have two folks that work on the help desk that have just done a tremendous job, Christian Pierce and Eddie Varela, nominated by their colleagues for their work in supporting them. Particularly, this is a good time to talk about this because, of course, this last few months we've gone to a lot of folks working remotely, and many of us have needed help. I'll put myself in that category of having needed help, and these guys have just not only been tireless, but congenial in the way that they deal with staff and open to the fact that some of us are not as technologically sophisticated as they are, and that really has been noticed in terms of the great customer service that they provide. So Christian Pierce and Eddie Varela are on the line here today, and we would like to just give them an opportunity. You know the rules here. We always tell people that we love for them to be present to receive their awards, and they have the opportunity if they'd like to say something to the board, but they're not required to. So, Christian, maybe you up first. Anything you would like to say?
Yeah. I appreciate the award, and it's been a little crazy, but you know, nothing we couldn't handle. Good, we have a good team here, so it makes it easy.
And Eddie, are you on the line today? Yeah, I had understood that actually this was his day off, so I'm not surprised that he didn't choose to come in for this, but we have been down to visit with him and let him know that we appreciate him. Next up, I want to talk about Tracy Yount and Rich Hyatt. Tracy and Rich, of course, have day jobs that you well know. Tracy leading the external affairs group and recently also taking on the safety group. Rich as the head of security for us. So a few months ago when COVID-19 came up, we asked them to lead the incident command structure team. which basically is, okay, you get to do an additional job in addition to the job that you're regularly doing. And both of them were recognized by their colleagues for their dedication to helping us get through COVID-19 activities. There was just a ton of stuff that needed to be done. I mean, all kinds of things, particularly supply chain issues and keeping track of the healthcare data in the community, how things were working in the field and getting that information up to management. It was really a terrific effort on their part, going certainly beyond what is required and being committed to our success. So we wanted to recognize both Tracy and Rich for their efforts, and again, would love to give them a chance, Tracy, if you're on, to say something to the board.
Yeah, this is Tracy. Thank you very much. I'd just like to say that there have been a couple of instances where things have happened at the district, and it's amazing to me how people come together to get stuff done when it's tough. And this is one of those situations. And I've really appreciated working with Rich, and it made the job, this task, I'll say enjoyable because how everybody's come together. It was a huge team, a lot of folks meeting daily, working with all the business units, and it really just was a team effort. And so I appreciate everybody for that.
Great. Thanks, Tracy. Rich, are you on the line today?
Yes, Steve, I am. Thank you very much. It's a humble honor to get recognized by your peers. This incident was very unique, very challenging, also very rewarding in that we worked as a team. We had tremendous support from the senior team. And there was about, at one point, 25-plus people on the ICS team. So it was tough, hurting the cats, but we did it. And I think we're in a good situation for going forward dealing with this kind. So thank you very much. Appreciate it.
All four of these folks do a great job of displaying personal accountability and stepping up to the plate when we really needed them to. So with that, I'll just turn it over to the board.
Thank you, Steve, and thank you to all of our winners, the CPO winners. You know, one of the unique things about Chelan PUD is everyone's willingness to step up during times of crisis or during times of need. I am just completely in awe at the quality of all the staff that we have and the job that they do and the fact that you can count on them to get the job done. So really appreciate everything that that these four folks have done and all the others as well, the countless others at the PUD. So moving on to item number five, and actually before I do that, let me ask if any of my other fellow commissioners have any comments. So I would move on to item number four, which is Rock Island Early Action Project Review, and Steve, you're going to talk about this. I'd like to set it up and preface it just a little bit. I'd like to have a presentation and hear what staff has to tell us, and then at the conclusion of staff's comments, I'd like to give the board members, the commissioners, opportunities to make their comment, and then at the conclusion of the commissioners' comments, I'd like to open the phones up for general public, if there are any public comments. So that'll be the format that we'll go ahead and follow.
Great. Okay. So we have Janelle Ulrich that's going to be making this presentation. Just a quick reminder that early action is a completely new concept that we take credit for bringing to the Congress and suggesting that there may be a better way to address licensing issues where you could actually take action in advance of going through the licensing process. There's nothing mandatory about this process. It's completely voluntary. It's a way to try to resolve issues early prior to actually going through the formal licensing process. So We have the law that gives us this opportunity. We've taken the first step, which is to solicit and find out who's interested. We've heard from folks, and now today we're here to talk to the board about what actions we could pursue. No action required here. This will just be a, if the board continues to be interested in taking the next step, just a head nod from the board to move forward. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Janelle.
Good morning, commissioners. This is Janelle Ulrich, Hydro Licensing Manager. Can you hear me okay?
Can hear you good.
Yes.
Thank you. Okay, so as stated, today I'm going to provide a review and recommendation of the 2020 Rock Island Relicensing EA proposal. Becca. Next slide, please. So today we'll cover the early action overview, remind folks what was involved, give you a brief summary of the four proposals received and results of a staff evaluation. And again, as Steve mentioned, we're seeking board concurrence on staff recommendations with the expectation that we would circle back with the proponents later this week with additional information as we gain it. Next slide. Anchoring back to who we are, our mission and our vision, is really important as we look at these proposals, which are primarily recreation and based, to know that it's our culture to go above and beyond. Traditionally, we've been a leader in recreation in the hydro industry. This is the third hydro license, FERC hydro license for Rock Island, and many recreational investments have been made in previous licenses, each with ongoing costs that continue in through that license. We expect our community wants us to protect and to continue to support these important recreational amenities that already exist on the Rock Island pond in plethora. Consistent with our mission and vision, the challenge will be to ensure that we continue to be a recreational leader without going too far. We don't want the Rock Island project to become uneconomical. Careful consideration when committing to early action efforts is warranted because the full relicensing process associated is coming, and it will bring other issues that need to be resolved, and those will bring required cost increases to this project. As Steve mentioned, we embarked on early action. In our strategic plan, we say that we'll pursue the identifications of actions that can result in a 50-year license for the Rock Island Dam, and that those actions must be identified before 2023. 2023, as a reminder, is the date that we owe a pre-application document and a notice of intent to FERC to start the relicensing process under the integrated licensing process. These hydropower early actions are supposed to be and need to be identified through our normal business planning process and our budgeting cycle. And we're soliciting or have solicited any ideas from different stakeholders as to what we could propose to be done in advance of the license. And the board has already committed to putting up $125,000 approximately to start the evaluation and development of these early actions. With that, they are asking for a commitment from the project sponsors to support a 50-year license term. Next slide. Before we get into the details of the evaluation of the early action criteria and the process we used in our recommendations, we'd like to point out a little bit of recreation benchmarking data to help anchor folks into what our recreational expenditures currently look like. What you see in front of you is benchmarking data that is taken from the whole of North America, from different participants all around North America, a lot of different hydro utilities. These are plants that have more than 400 megawatts of power who participated and provided recreational data from the years of 2013 through the years of 2018. You'll notice that the number of plants vary based on the benchmarking year, and that the cost is based on the dollars of recreation spent on labor, contracts, and other sources per net megawatt of capacity that that plant has. So it's normalized for the water year to help answer that question. As you look at this, you'll notice that Rocky Reach and Rock Island, consistent with our desire to be recreational leaders, indeed are recreational leaders in the industry, having spent 2 to 4 times the average on our recreational costs per net megawatt for those two projects. Indeed, Rock Island was ranked as the most expensive or the highest spender, if you will, in 2018 of dollars per net megawatt of capacity. So that puts things in perspective. FERC wouldn't necessarily expect us to add additional recreation enhancements, given that we already are, indeed, as proven by these data, recreational leaders. So at that point, it becomes a choice as to what does our board and what does our community want from us and with their precious dollars. Next slide, please. So when we made a request for early action proposals, which occurred in late January from a solicitation letter that was sent to a variety of different stakeholders, we asked them, the proponents, to consider the project nexus, meaning how does what they're proposing have anything to do with ongoing project operations at Rock Island, in support of a 50-year license. We also asked them that the proposal support recreation, public access, environmental stewardship, education, or cultural resources. These are normal things that we would expect to see during a relicensing process. We asked for cost-sharing and partner opportunities to make sure that we were all in this together, and we asked for demonstrated public support. The deadline for proposals was March 23rd. Staff reviewed the proposals and met with the proponents to clarify the proposals. We conducted an assessment using a tool called a value framework. We then met with the commissioners and explained to them individually how the assessment process worked and answered any of their questions. We learned from the board that they had an interest in dividing up the funding that was available, the approximately $125,000, to meet the intent of what each proponent asked for as much as could be possible. And they had a real interest in dialing into what the Chelan PUD could actually do within our authority and how that would be in our best interest for the long-term total investment as it related to Rock Island relicensing. Next slide. So I'm going to use a couple slides here to explain how the value framework tool works. It's basically a prioritizing tool that's used by a good number of our peer utilities. In fact, we gained it by working with other peer utilities who've been using it for quite a while, and it seemed to work pretty well for this particular application. The value framework asks us to find value for things that are hard to financially value. So those include, if there's financial risk, that's easier, but safety, environmental stewardship, compliance, and stakeholder and customer relationships. And it can even work for distribution outages that may not create a financial burden, but do damage to our local community, which is something we care about a lot. When looking at using this tool for this early action proposal, we recognize that environmental stewardship and four specific areas of customer stakeholder relationships were really important so that we could ensure that we could give points to each of the proposals based on environmental value, the recreational value, any education, economic value, that's socioeconomic, and any cost sharing. Next slide, please. So we basically take and sum together all of these value points, as we call them, as you'll see in the top of that equation, and we multiply those value points by a score that we call project achievability. This project achievability is really the likelihood that we actually can gain this value. So it considers authority, are we allowed to do something? Nexus, is it part of the Rock Island relicensing project and related to the project impacts of Rock Island? Is it consistent with stakeholder support? Remember, if we have a variety of different stakeholders with conflicting ideas, and particularly if they're agencies or tribes who have legal authority, we may not be able to do something. So we had to consider that. Clarity of the proposal. There were areas where we weren't sure, so we weren't sure if we could do it. And, of course, executability. Once we have those total points and we multiply it by the project value, we then took the low expected cost, which can be challenging to get, but it was the total cost to Chelan PUD, what was expected over the entire life. So if there was an investment that was going to require maintenance and operation, we included an estimate for those and basically linearly extrapolated them across a 50-year license. So the total cost gets converted to the point system as well, and that becomes the denominator. What it gives us back is something what business people are used to. They're used to a business cost or cost benefit, ratio, but it gives us back a value cost ratio. So this is a way of monetizing or quantifying, rather, things that we value that are hard to get to with money. So that's how the process worked. Next slide, please. These were our results. So as we mentioned, we received four different proposals. The proposals are numbers 1 through 4 on the left side, and there's different alternatives or different recommendations within these proposals. Particularly the Audubon Society had a list of very interesting and fun different ideas that they wanted brought forward. In the cases where those ideas were exceeded $125,000, we didn't evaluate them, but they are on the record for consideration during relicensing. Again, I remind you that the projects that we're talking about here are a look at the total project proposed with the total expected cost, considered both on the high end and the low end over the entire license. That was what was evaluated. As we move down the list, you'll notice that Malaga asked for a site suitability and traffic impact study to help them move towards getting to a waterfront park. We took a high cost for a park and a low cost for a park and evaluated those and found that in the case of a low cost alternative, then we end up with a positive value-cost ratio. It's green because it's greater than 1, so the value is greater than the cost. If we were to go with a more expensive option for what that park might look like, you'll notice that no longer does Malaga Parkway look to be highly beneficial. In fact, its cost now exceeds its value ratio, or value, so the overall ratio is now less than 1, or in the red. The City of Rock Island proposed the development of a recreation of a vision and a strategic plan to look at all, a variety of enhancements for the Rock Island Ponds and their waterfront area adjacent to the Columbia River. There's a lot of different alternatives that could show up there and a lot of different expensive costs that would be quite extreme and would require long-term maintenance and operation. That results in the low value cost ratios that you see there. Frankly, the denominator or the cost is just very, very high. We went ahead and provided a PUD option as an alternative for this case because we heard from the board that they were very interested in making sure that all of the proponents, they would like us to try to work with all of the proponents in a way that does provide value to the PUD customer owners for which we have authority. So knowing that we own land out at the Rock Island Ponds, we proposed that we evaluated improving the access to those ponds on our property, consistent with a recreation plan that Rock Island shared with us in the past. And that's what you see up there as 2B. The North Central Washington Audubon Society, as I mentioned, provided a variety of different proposals, and you can see on the screen how they ranked as we went throughout. The City of Wenatchee provided improving the loop trail in Wenatchee across the entire length between the two bridges on the Chelan County side. It was a fairly expensive proposal at $70,000, and given the intent of the board to try to make sure that we were sensitive to the intent of each of our proponents, we came back with an alternative that would only study a portion of it at a reduced cost, and that would be the portions between Walla Walla and Pybus Market. Those are highly congested areas, we expect. Data will need to substantiate that, and that was why we went ahead and provided that as an alternative. If the proponents decide, if we decide to go into an agreement and do the alternative, we would still be asking for support of a 50-year license for the Chelan PUD option. Final slide, please. So here's our recommendation for the use of the approximately $125,000 that the board has allocated for early action. We're recommending that we propose that we go ahead and help the Chelan County and Malaga Clackam Community Council to help with their site suitability and traffic impact for a future Malaga Park. They are putting up half the money, so the money you see there is our half. The total is twice that. We're also recommending that we embark on a study to look at improving the Rock Island Pond access points on the property that we own. The Audubon Society, we took a couple of their proposals and brought those together and suggested that we designed some pieces of the Horan Natural Area trail system, the direction of some of the benches, the ability to have pathways that are sort of intent on the water where paddle borders should go and such were things of interest, and they're well within our ability to do and might provide a lot of value for our customer owners and others who visit the area, as well as they're willing to participate in providing volunteer hours to implement ongoing long-range bird studies out at the Rock Island Ponds, similar to work that they've done in the past in the Haran Natural Area. And we could support them in the setup of those studies and making sure that those data are being collected in a meaningful way. They have a lot of experts who volunteer their time, so that's great cost-sharing in its own way. And the final proposal is that we go ahead and, as I mentioned, look at the Apple Capitol Loop Trail between Pybus and Walla Walla to see if there's ways in which we could improve the safety and the use for all of our various customer owners and visitors to our area for a sum total of slightly over the recommended cost of $125,000. Two points of interest that I think really need to be stated is that the proposals above are contingent on the parties attesting to a good faith commitment that we will get through the relicensing process together as partners, and that they would be, at the end of that, willing to support a 50-year license as part of the memorandum of understanding of our committing these fundings in advance of the Rock Island relicensing process. However, if they don't want to, or any of the other options that were brought forward aren't gone, they still will be considered during the normal relicensing timeframe process. So they aren't something that goes away. It's just a not yet. It's not to be used for early action. So with that, I'd like to turn it back to the board for further discussion.
And if I could Commissioner Arso, I just make one clarification point on that MOU. The commitment to support a 50-year license would be if the project itself comes to fruition, not just if we provide the design money. With that, I thought Janelle did a really excellent job of covering a lot of material in a short period of time. Back to you, Commissioner Arso.
Thank you, Steve. Yes, Janelle, great presentation. Thank you. Commissioners, any thoughts, comments?
Gary, this is Ann.
Hi, Ann.
Hi. Are we, we're not moving on to, we're still going to discuss the early action. This is just the first part of it, correct? I mean, I just kind of have an overreaching comment to make, but I'm not sure if now is the appropriate time.
I think we're going to be calling for a vote on whether or not to move forward allocating this $127,000. So this may be the time.
Oh, okay. All right. Thank you. So I'm just in listening to this and reading about it, this reminds me of the the really innovative terrific approach we took with the Habitat Conservation Plan, the HCP, going way back, I think, to the 80s, which was something new. No other utility had looked at it this way. We had certain goals that we had to meet, and instead of having the federal government say, okay, you have to achieve these goals in terms of fish passage and so forth, and you have to achieve the goals, and this is how you're going to have to do it. You're going to have to do this, this, and this in this order. And so our folks brilliantly went to them and proposed that, yes, we will meet these goals, but since we are on the ground and we have our folks who do this kind of work all the time, let's let them, figure out the path and how we're going to do it. And of course, it was much more effective and more efficient and less cost, and we did achieve the goals. So this, to me, is another innovative new way of approaching something that our brilliant staff has come up with, and it's going to be a better way. I'm certain it's going to be a better way to approach it. So my applause and congratulations, terrific. I'm just so impressed. Thank you.
Thank you, Ann.
Gary, this is Randy.
Yes, Randy.
I'm glad I hesitated and let Ann go first, because I think what I'm about to say is will dovetail on what she says, but it will be substantially different. As I think about this presentation, and it was a marvelous presentation and a great jump start for one of the, in my estimation, the single most important things we do as commissioners maintain our assets, and one of the ways we maintain our assets is through the relicensing project of our projects. And I think back, since I've been around here long enough, to the 1970s, when maybe it even started a little bit in the 1960s with Kirby Billingsley and Exhibit R. And the process we went through to first establish the recreational benefits for the Chelan Public Utility and the licensing process, I'm not certain that we had quite the public input at that point in time that we've had this go around. And I think I for one, and I think all five of us commissioners really, really value the public input that has been generated over the last several years for what this recreation program for our utility should look like as it relates to relicensing. And relicensing comes around once, hopefully, every 50 years and no sooner. We all want that 50-year license, but for those of us that are current commissioners, this is a really beginning of a really special moment in time. And I want to remind all of my fellow commissioners, maybe some are aware, some are not, whatever projects we do get moving forward and get approved as a part of our license will then become part of the rate structure of the power being generated from Rock Island Dam. And I remember clearly back the last go-around, part of the single biggest selling point of the Exhibit R, and it still holds true, was the fact that we sell half of the power from that dam to outside entities on, at that moment in time, it was on long-term contracts, and those outside entities actually were helping us to improve the recreational access here in Chelan County, so the residents of Chelan County really didn't have to handle the full cost of what was going on. And so there's a real opportunity here for us to provide a benefit to the people of Chelan County. And with the input we've received, huge kudos to our staff for the hard work they put in. This list looks marvelous. There's other worthy projects there, but they're not ruled out necessarily as we go down, as we know that this is only early action we're talking about. It doesn't bake any of these actions into our license request, but it starts the process, which is so important, of the public sharing with us and with ultimately with FERC what we want to see here for our utility. So thank you, staff, for a marvelous job. Sorry if this was a little bit of a rambling history lesson, but we've got a legacy here that is really important to the residents of Chelan County. Thank you.
Well said, Randy.
Hi, Gary, Dennis.
Yes, Dennis.
Yeah, just would like to reiterate and compliment Ann and Randy on their analysis and their ability to conceptualize what's in front of us. And just add just that little bit that Randy really hit on something that's very, very important. When you take a look at the licensing of all of our dams and the combined assets that we've been able to develop based on our surplus sales, 19% of what we produce in our three dams is used locally. 81% is sold outside. And so the benefit of outside entities contributing to the well-being and economic development of Chelan County, you know, is at that 81% level. And who else has that business model available to them in any way, shape, or form? And if you just simply take a look at the parks alone and the fact that between 3 and 4 million people a year visit our parks and utilize their recreational facilities that are provided, you know, by the dams and the hydroelectric production. Again, the payback to Chelan County in terms of tourism dollars, in our local economy is just outstanding. And to be able to begin to conceptualize the next 50 years, get an early lead on some of those projects that are floating to the surface as basically a higher desire by our constituents that support us, it is really noteworthy. And the last thing, you know, being said on that is Ann said it well, and so did Randy, that this is only the beginning. There will be other opportunities. If you have a pet project or something that you're really wanting to see happen, this is just the initial stage. We have yet begun to fight, you know, and so there's plenty of opportunity to continue to take that next 50-year look and enhance the well-being of all of our public in Chelan County and our economic development as well. And what a golden opportunity, no pun intended. So thanks for listening.
Thank you, Dennis. Well said. Well, I'll jump in and say that my fellow commissioners have taken most of the comments that I might also say. I do feel strongly that the opportunity for Chelan PUD over the years to provide for recreation within the county, whether that has to do with the Horan Natural Area and the Audubon Society that takes part down there, or whether it has to do with any and all of our parks. It's a marvelous gift, and as my fellow commissioners have pointed out, much of the cost has been paid by those power sales that take place outside of the county, and so it's been a gift to Chelan County to be able to have this opportunity. And with that, I will I'll conclude and open up at this time our phones for any of the public that might be on the line that would care to make a comment at this time. Once again, please state your name and your address for the record, and again, please limit your comments to 3 minutes.
Is there a general sequence, or can we just jump in?
Well, you're the first one to speak, so first come, first served.
All right. My name is Bruce McCammon. I'm with the North Central Washington Audubon Society, and I live here in Wenatchee. The Audubon Society has a long-standing history of involvement in both the Rock Island Ponds and the Horan Natural Area, in actively participating in all the meetings and opportunities to provide input about the potential for these really unique and highly valued areas in Chelan County. Certainly within the Rock Island Project Nexus. I'm most qualified to talk about the Horan area. I've spent the last 3 years working on identifying potential opportunities in there that would increase and enhance the economic, the social, and the environmental conditions in there. The proposal that North Central Washington Audubon submitted to the PUD for early action includes several different projects, and I'm glad to hear that the ones that aren't under consideration in the early action area will still be on the docket for consideration in the relicensing process. So we'll continue to support those ideas, and we look forward to working on any input we can provide and support we can provide through partnership on the early action trail work and whatever comes along with that. But just quickly summarize the high-value projects that we look forward to in the future. The three that I think are the most important of the ones on there is the reintroduction of water flowing through the Horan area in conjunction with a reconfiguration of the steep-sided ponds that are there to provide better habitat for waterfowl and a variety of shorebirds, as well as the aesthetics for recreational use in the area. Second one is reestablishment of a Native American presence in the area. This area has a history, a very rich history for Native American use that's absent in the area today and could easily be reestablished to add that cultural value and the recreational values back into it. The last thing on the top three, for me anyway, is the creation of a vegetative management plan for the area that would guide the PUD and parks or the managers to enhance the populations of native plants and culturally important plants in the Horan area, minimizing weeds, and to inform a maintenance program of vegetation throughout the area. So I just summarize by saying we really appreciate the many opportunities I've had for direct conversation with the PUD staff, people on the ground, and the opportunities to formally input Audubon desires and ideas to the PUD process over the last 4 years. We look forward to a continuation on that.
Thank you very much.
Gary, this is Ann.
Yes, Ann.
I missed the gentleman's name. I appreciated his comments. I'm an Audubon person myself, so I just would like to hear his name again.
Sure. My name is Bruce McCammon. I am on the board for North Central Washington Audubon.
Yeah, okay. McCammon?
McCammon, yes.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Are there any other comments public interested in making?
If I could, Mr. Chair, this is Mike Caputo with Chelan County.
Yes, Mike.
Thank you very much. So, Mike Caputo, I'm the director of the Chelan County Natural Resources Department. I work for the Chelan County Commissioners. Commissioner Overbay had hoped to be here. Our commissioners are also having session this morning, so that couldn't make that happen here. First, I want to thank the PUD for your leadership on the early action process. Thank you very much for that. A few things about the Malaga Park proposal that I just wanted to reaffirm from the joint letter that was sent by the county commissioners and the Malaga Calacum Community Council. First, we're committed to the $37,500 in matching funds, the 50-50 split that Janelle noted. We're excited about the partnership with the Malaga Calacum Community Council and excited to work with the PUD on this proposal. And again, just wanted to reaffirm our support for the 50-year Rock Island license. We've sent in a couple of letters from our commissioners previously supporting that, and we will continue to support that moving forward. So we have very much enjoyed working with your staff on this up to this point, and we look forward to working with them in the future. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike. Are there any other public comments?
This is Herb Gardner, Malaga Clackam Community Council.
Yes, Herb.
I listened to your presentation, Janelle. That's a good job. And we appreciate that. We appreciate the PUD working with us in the county to take a look and study possible park areas in Malaga. I was just thinking when I was listening to McKinnon, the Audubon Society, if we have a park down here, they should be coming down here to check out our eagles, ospreys, and turkey vultures that we now have lurking over the river. So it would be interesting to see what improvements would happen if the park was here, because there are currently no trees in the areas. Well, there are a few in the orchards, but where we're looking at parks, there's it's orchard, not trees that birds would sit in. But we would look forward to having a park in this area, and unable to see what Janelle was presenting. I like the fact that, number one, they have a good value. I'm not sure what her changes were that created a lower value, and I'd be interested in seeing that happen. But we would support. We support the dam. Obviously, it's a very important thing for our county. We are hoping for a park because Malaga is one of the few places that doesn't have something on the river at this point. So, thank you for your work, and we hope to continue this early action and see what happens. Thank you.
Thank you, Herb. Are there any other public comments?
Good morning. My name is Laura Merrill from the City of Wenatchee.
This is Vicki Malloy in Malaga, Malaga Community Council.
Oh. Can you hear me?
Say, what I wanted to talk about was the fact that the Malaga community itself is the most underserved community on the river within the project range. And as you can see, there's little expansion that's possible up to the north of Wenatchee. But a lot of expansion is talked about to the Malaga community and beyond. And with that in mind, I think it would be advantageous not only to our community but to the county to have a park here to service the area and to have waterfront access, which Malaga does not have currently, and basically to just build up a positive a place for people to be. And that's basically all I have to say. Thank you.
Thanks, Vicki. Laura, you wanted to make a comment?
Oh, yes. Sorry, I thought my microphone wasn't working. This is Laura Merrill with the City of Wenatchee. I just wanted to thank you all for your support. Our proposal for the to study the portions of the Apple Capitol Loop Trail and some of the user conflicts, I think it'll be a really great and interesting study. We're excited to see the results, and especially as we look to hopefully move forward with Confluence Parkway and all of the various projects that will improve that area. And so, again, just wanted to say thank you, and you know, the city also supports the relicensing project, so we're happy to you know, send in a letter, whatever you need, moving forward on that. And thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you, Laura. Are there any other public comment?
This is Herb Troxell. I'd like to comment.
Yes, Herb, go ahead.
Helen mentioned the fact that it's growing out here. A lot of orchards coming out, a lot of new houses being built, houses built up on the hillside. It's a little frustrating to people out here to have a river right in front of them and have to drive 6, 8, 10 miles around to the other side to put their boats in, to recreate on the river. And the Malaga community has been working for a long time trying to get a park going. And we have a start of one, but it would really be great to be able to use the river like everybody else does. It's right at our doorstep. Thank you.
Thank you, Irv. Any other public comment?
President Arsenault, this is Dennis.
Yes, go ahead, Dennis.
Is Bruce McCammon, are you still on the line?
Yes, I am.
A question I have is I haven't been able to get clarity. We talked about establishing recognition of the Native American population at the mouth of the Wenatchee. My question is, do you know if the north side or the south side was more dominantly used by the Native Americans? Or was there equity in the use of both sides of the river? And I've just not been able to get a clear answer on that. Just wondered if you had any additional insight.
I've talked with Randy Lewis, the Native American elder representing the Wenatchee Band, several times. It's my understanding that there used to be a permanent establishment on the north side of the Wenatchee River in the Confluence Park area during times when there were council activities going on with multiple tribes. They used both sides of the river, East Wenatchee and Wenatchee River. So it was a a comprehensive use of the entire area on both sides of the Columbia during major gatherings, and probably more long-term use on the north side of the river, of the Wenatchee River, on non-council timeframes.
Okay, thank you very much for that clarification. Much appreciated.
Thank you for the question. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Are there any other comments? Hearing no other comments, Steve, I'd like to turn it back over to you.
Commissioners, I think what we need at this point is to be, there's no formal action that's required by the board, so we don't need a formal vote. What we would like to know is, this is, if we were all in the same room, we would call it the head nod approach. Since we're not, we'll call it the, is there any objection to staff continuing to proceed down the path as it's described in the presentation here today? Hearing none, then I think we've got what we need, which is we will continue to work with these parties, and next step will be to develop memorandums of understanding about what it would take to move forward with spending on the pre-design work, and also to better define that pre-design work. And we will get back to the board once we've moved through that process.
Thank you, Steve.
With that, we are prepared to move to the next action item, which is the Integrated Resource Plan. We've got Becky Keating here in the room. She's coming up. If we have folks that provided comment on the last item and they want to leave, this would be an appropriate time for that. Of course, they're always welcome to stay to hear the rest of the presentations this morning.
Good morning, Commissioners. This is Becky Keating, Senior Analyst from Energy Planning and Trading. I'm here today to continue our discussion of the 2020 Integrated Resource Plan process. No board action is being requested of you today. You may recall we came on May 11th with our initial portfolio analysis results, and I want to let you know there's no changes in our load or resource numbers from those initial results, but we are here today to provide you with the draft document and as well as some additional information in the IRP document. The board has the ability to make changes to the document, however, we don't anticipate substantial changes. We are scheduled to come back be in front of you on July 6th to ask for your approval by resolution of the draft document. And I just want to say a quick thank you to all departments who helped with this, and Energy Resources, Finance, the District's Load Group, Communications, Generation, Real Estate Services, Legal, and Office Services. Today's presentation, we're going to talk about district summary of recommendations, give you a little bit of information on the new Washington State Clean Energy Transformation Act, and as part of that act, a little information on the Clean Energy Action Plan, as well as resource adequacy requirements in the Clean Energy Transformation Act, and go over the remaining board and public process schedule. So the district is retaining its same basic recommendations from all of its IRPs and progress reports since 2008, which provide customer owners with reliable, low-cost, carbon-free resources through the planning period, which goes through 2030. So those are retaining the district's current mix of generating resources to meet load and renewable requirements of the Washington Renewable Portfolio Standard, continuing to evaluate and implement conservation potential programs through use of the 2019 Conservation Potential Assessment, and plan to keep evaluating implementing strategies for additional power sales contracts consistent with financial policies and the hedging strategy. The Clean Energy Transformation Act was signed into law by Governor Inslee in 2019. It has three primary sections. Section 3 being the elimination of coal-fired resources in Washington by 2025. Section 4 being the Washington being greenhouse gas neutral by 2030. And Section 5 with Washington State becoming serving 100% of retail load with renewable or non-emitting resources by 2045. The rulemaking for this law is extensive and ongoing. Expected to continue until 2022, and the district is fully engaged in this process. This law is not currently altering any district decisions. The Clean Energy Action Plan is part of the Clean Energy Transformation Act, and it's one of those portions of it that affects the IRP law, which is RCW 19280. It's a 10-year plan for implementing those sections 3, 4, and 5 that I just discussed, and specifically at the lowest reasonable cost and at an acceptable resource adequacy standard that identifies the specific actions to be taken by the utility consistent with the long-range plan. These bullets on this slide are what is the district's 2020 Clean Energy Action Plan and its 2020 IRP. And those are to meet those requirements in sections 3, 4, and 5, we are our plan is to retain our existing mix of renewable generating resources through the planning period and pursue conservation and efficiency actions. District does not anticipate needing to take any other actions during the planning period to prepare for the greenhouse gas neutral standard in 2030, nor does the district anticipate needing to take any other actions during the planning period to prepare for the 100% of retail sales from renewable and non-emitting resources by 2045. The resource adequacy is mentioned in several of the new provisions of the CETA law, which in particular affect the integrated resource plan. They expect it's affecting all utilities and expecting the utilities to develop a determination of resource adequacy metrics for their resource plans consistent with their forecasts. Currently, the Northwest Power Pool is developing a capacity resource adequacy program to help manage resource adequacy in a coordinated manner in the region. Their program is looking out, under development, and it's looking out 1 to 4 years to develop common measures of adequacy and an approach for allocation of the resource adequacy requirement among participants, methods to make the most benefit of regional diversity, and working on incentive and enforcement mechanisms, and it will be voluntary to join. However, once joined, utilities are contractually committed to the requirements. The district is also actively involved with developing this RA program. So here we are on our 2020 Integrated Resource Plan schedule. As I mentioned earlier, we're scheduled to come back on July 6th and ask for your approval by resolution of the draft document that you've been provided. And that will allow the IRP to be submitted to the Department of Commerce by September 1st. I do like to just remind the board that they're not locked into any portfolio or resource plan. That's in this IRP, the board can take action at any time to change directions as far as the district's portfolio goes.
Commissioners, any comments? So, should we call for a motion here?
No, I'm sorry. No action today. We'll be back July 6th.
Okay, good. All right. Well, if there are no comments or questions from the fellow commissioners, thank you very much, Vicki.
Thank you.
Okay, next up is our agenda item 6, which is the insurance program renewal update. Ron Gibbs will be doing what is an annual presentation to the board. Ron, take it away.
Good morning, commissioners. Ron Gibbs, insurance and claims manager. And we're going to actually begin on slide 2. And as Steve mentioned, it is time again for the annual update on the insurance premiums as we work towards the renewal date of July 1st. And the premiums I'll be sharing today are based on the combination of quotes that we've received, as well as estimates on what we expect to be the final outcome from negotiation. And we will continue to get additional quotes to negotiate all the way up to the July 1st renewal date. And similar to what we've done in years past, we will be requesting your authorization to renew our insurance program through a motion with a not-to-exceed amount at the end of the presentation. And you can see we've got $3,300,000 listed there. Moving on to slide 3. So our efforts to obtain the best insurance available at the best pricing available supports the district value of stewardship by protecting public resources, managing risk, and controlling costs. And despite the challenges of COVID this year, our brokers and I were able to meet remotely with the insurance underwriters. And in those meetings, we always highlight the strengths of the district in order to make the case to underwriters that we are a top-tier client for them to insure. And that way, we hope to get the best pricing and terms. With property underwriters this year, we presented on the information that our large investments that we are making with continually modernizing our hydro generation, and also how we are focused on the quality of our designs and construction using design-build contracts. And we updated them on progress made with our asset management program and with our partnerships in the Hydro Research Institute. And I would just say the overarching theme of the message to underwriters this year for property was that we are an innovative and proactive leader in public power. In the liability underwriter meeting, I encountered many questions regarding wildfire risk mitigation, and we had sort of anticipated that, so the presentation focused heavily on the work of our internal wildfire risk working group, including the efforts of the transmission and distribution department to review our vegetation management program. Of course, with wildfire risk mitigation, tree trimming is a very big part of that. So we talked about the study also that was completed last fall and how enhancements to the vegetation management program are under development. And we talked about the upcoming wildfire risk modeling work that will take place this summer. And that will attempt to identify the highest risk locations in our T&D system so that we can focus our mitigations where they are most needed. And at Health this year, also our primary liability insurance carrier, they conducted a 3-day review of all of our operations that could impact the liability, and their final report actually had no recommendations for us. So that was, I think, helpful for our underwriters. Although I will say that assessment did not focus, just on vegetation management, so it was a very broad focus. Moving on to slide 4. This year is proving to be one of the most challenging in the 20 years that I've been working on the district insurance program. The global property and casualty insurance markets are dramatically hardening. And, over the last few years, as the world economy has heated up, we've seen demand for insurance go up, and that's put pressure on the rates for rate increases. So that's really the driver here. COVID has not helped because the financial market fluctuations have impacted how the insurance companies are investing their reserves, and so they're not getting the returns maybe that they've gotten in years past. So that's another pressure for insurance companies. Insurance industry publications are reporting average rate increases in excess of 20%, for 2020 so far. One reported this is the hardest market since 9/11. And I was actually just beginning my work at the PUD in 9/11, and that was, we saw 30% increases that year. So this is definitely an unusual year. In my underwriter meetings, I heard about how the utility industry in general has performed very poorly in recent years. Our primary property insurer, which is called Aegis, you may have heard of them, they exclusively insure utilities, and they said they haven't, they've been in the red now for 5 years straight. So they are directed by management. They have to see increases in their premiums to help make up for the gaps they've had. I'm also part of an LPPC group of insurance professionals, and we meet regularly with conference calls to share information and collaborate. And on a recent call, everybody in the group was, had an informal poll about, you know, what types of premium increases they'd seen in recent renewals, and literally everyone was in the 20 to 30% range on the property insurance. So I just want to get the message that we're not alone in dealing with a difficult market this year, and I think we also might be seeing some impacts because we've had our, you know, we had the settlement of the claims at Rocky Reach for the servo rod losses, and we received a payment last year of $17 million, and the insurance companies are seeing that as well. Also, our property values have gone up 5%. So even if there had been a flat rate for this year, our premiums would have gone up 5%. And those are based on construction indexes that we have to update our values annually. So that was another pressure on our premiums this year. On the liability side, there's a lot of concern, as I mentioned, about wildfire risk. And I believe that's impacting our premiums. Some of the insurance models place us in a higher risk zone. And we also heard from underwriters that jury awards in general have been increasing really dramatically, and that also impacts the premiums. That's one of the reasons they're saying that they need higher premiums this year. For the 2020 budget, we did anticipate significant increases because of the market conditions we were seeing last fall, and so we budgeted for some larger increases. The markets have changed even more than we had expected when we set our budget, so we will be a little bit over budget this year as the quotes are coming in. On slide five, you can see some of the historical information for the property insurance. Negotiations so far for property insurance have resulted in estimated premiums of $1,650,000, and that represents a 27% increase as it stands today. I do remain hopeful that we'll be able to continue to negotiate that down, however. That said, we still haven't even received quotes for 30% of our property program, and that's despite, you know, definite pressure on our broker from myself and the broker onto the underwriters to get quotes in. But because of the hard market, they've been very slow to get quotes out this year. For the general liability on slide six, you can see that we show an estimated 25% increase for liability insurance. One of the seven insurance carriers, we have to purchase a number of different policies cover our $150 million limit. And one of those carriers quoted a 50% increase this year. And that has impacts on the other policy pricing because they all see what the others are doing. So fortunately, it didn't work out where it was as big an impact as we had thought earlier last week. And we received quotes Friday from almost all of the remaining insurance layers. We still have one outstanding. But the estimate you see up here of $1,330,000 is actually going to be high, we believe, now. And the new number is $1,264,000. So that would represent an 18.6% increase. We are trying to come up with an option to replace that carrier that quoted us a 50% increase. I'm being told by the brokers it's really difficult to find insurance companies right now at this pricing level for utilities just because of all of the wildfire issues that have happened down in California. So, you know, as a utility with a wildfire exposure, it's really difficult to find new markets to come in. But we're working as hard as we can to make that happen. Slide seven shows how the overall program costs have fluctuated over the years. And with the new liability quotes that we received Friday, the number you see for the 2020 to 2021 has changed down to $3,030,000 as opposed to $3,112,000. slide 8, it shows a summary of the estimated renewal pricing this year compared to last year. Again, since the time that we had to finalize these presentations, we've gotten these new numbers, so they're a little bit better than what you're seeing up there. We anticipate now a 22% overall program increase this year, which is 4% higher than our what we budgeted. Slide 9 includes our recommendation that we complete the annual negotiation process with a not-to-exceed amount of $3,300,000 for premium renewals with commission approval by motion. And we typically request an additional amount over our estimated cost in case quotes come in higher than we expect. This year, we've added more flexibility in the number than we have in years past. So since the board meeting is earlier this year, and as I mentioned, because the underwriters are taking longer to get their quotes in this hard market, we had fewer quotes in place than we typically do when we set in this number. So when I finalized this presentation, we only had quotes for 60% of the property program and 50% of the liability program. But since we've gotten the new numbers in on Friday, we have much more certainty on the liability side. But as I said before, we still need quotes for 30% of our property insurance program. And, you know, this year has already had some surprisingly large increases in some quotes. And so we've been conservative in setting the not-to-exceed amount this year. On slide 10, we've just got our next steps, which are to continue to pursue and negotiate the best insurance and terms and conditions that we can and complete the insurance policy renewal by July 1st. And then we'll just be asking for a motion and if there are any questions.
Commissioners, are there any questions for Ron?
Yeah, Gary, this is Dennis. Ron, I have a question related to the design build insurance piece. Insurance companies are notoriously skittish on something that's relatively new and not tried and true. So when you take a look at our premium for our construction utilizing design build, are we seeing a substantial increase in our premium? Premium remaining about the same? Premium being reduced because it's a better method? So just question along in that line.
Sure. Thank you, Commissioner. You know, insurance companies keep their methodologies for how they quote premiums very close to the vest, and they do that because of they don't want the competition understanding how they come up with their figures. So they don't share with us directly how they come up with their premium dollars. And so what I have to do oftentimes is try and glean from the questions I get during my underwriter meetings on what issues they're concerned with. This year, I wouldn't say that I heard many questions or concerns about our design build process itself. You're right, though, that anytime you have new construction, that presents new risks. So I'm sure that there was some factor that played into premium pricing, but they of course, didn't divulge that because of their confidentiality concerns. So I can't answer with certainty exactly what that number is. I'm sure there was some insurance companies, I'm sure, had that played a role. But at the end of the day, they also appreciate the investments that we make in our resources, and they appreciate that we're not letting our equipment run till it fails and then present an insurance claim to the insurance companies to help pay for it. They want to see us replacing equipment well in advance of failure. So that one with our asset management program where we're really managing that process also, I think, is a benefit for us with insurance companies overall.
Okay, thank you.
You bet.
Well, this is Steve McKenna. I have a couple of questions for you. On page 6, the limit amount of $150 million, could you just review that for me for a minute? And don't let me forget that I have a question on, well, I can just ask the second question. The number of providers, I believe you said we have 7 carriers that provide our insurance. Is that correct?
Right.
Has that number gone up over time, or is that pretty consistent? Has it gone down? What happens to that? What do you see with that number historically over time?
So if you look at the bottom of the slide, you'll see a note that says limits were increased $25 million in 2015 and then again in 2019. Mm-hmm. And I would say that the what we've done over the last, those increases represent analysis of our wildfire risk. And they've gone up, I think it was in 2012, they were as low as $75 million. So since 2012, we've essentially doubled the liability limit. And that's based on some information that we've seen with local fires and the costs that were involved. But we're not just relying on our own analysis. I mentioned that we're having some modeling done to identify the high-risk lines. Part of that modeling will include an assessment of what our exposure is, potential exposure is, if we were to cause a fire, and what, you know, when you think about things like what we might be on the hook for firefighting costs or property damage or, God forbid, bodily injury. All those things are going to be evaluated in this modeling that's going to happen over the summer, and we hope to have that information by the end of the summer. And that will be informative as we think about what insurance limits make sense for us going forward. But, yes, it has gone up fairly significantly over time, I think, as we've seen the wildfire risk exposure become, you know, a concern for us as we think about global warming and just what we've witnessed with the local fires over the last decade.
Great. Thank you very much.
You bet.
Did the number of providers?
Okay, so I'm not sure. We have seven insurance providers. And the reason is because insurance companies, it's hard to find. It would be impossible, I think, to find any insurance company that would take on the whole $150 million limit. Our primary insurance company, Aegis, covers $35 million, and then we have various parts and pieces all the way up to the $150 million, just based on what insurance companies are willing to do. So it's just a factor of what's available to us.
Mm-hmm. And has that changed over time?
It's changed as we've added liability insurance over time, but it might fluctuate over the years. You know, you might gain capacity with one insurance company as they become more familiar with our risk. Or I think 2 years ago, we had one insurance company that quit writing utility business altogether, so we had to replace that layer and shuffle things around. So there are times where the amount of insurance by each insurance company do fluctuate over time.
Mm-hmm. Great. Okay. That's very helpful. Thank you very much.
Of course.
Any other questions for Rob? Okay, Ron, thank you. I guess this is the time we would have entertained a motion.
Gary, this is Randy.
Yes, Randy.
I would move to authorize expenditures by the district not to exceed $3,300,000 plus surplus lines, taxes, and fees for the purchase of district insurance for July 1, 2020 through 2021 policies upon terms and conditions approved by the general manager.
So we have a motion. Do we have a second?
Second.
So it's been moved and seconded. Is there any discussion? The only thing that I will jump in and say, and I've had this brief conversation with General Manager Steve Wright earlier today, that back in my investment days when we were faced with our annual increase for insurance for our company, it was not uncommon to see 30% increases back-to-back year over year at our firm. And it just takes your breath away after a while. So I certainly understand what Ron's going through and the difficulty with which the environment that he's operating to try to find us the best deal possible. So having said that, we have a motion. It's been seconded. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed say nay. The ayes have it. Thanks, Ron.
Thank you very much, Commissioners.
Okay, thank you, Commissioners. Next up, we have been doing work for a while now to update our transmission policies, and embedded in that are transmission rates. I want to invite Chad Bowman to make this presentation.
Good morning, Commissioners. I'm Chad Bowman, the Director of Transmission Compliance. Here to talk about transmission rates. There is no action required today, although we do plan to or would like to bring a resolution back on July 6th to approve the transmission rates that are that separate attachment to your board agenda. On page 2, slide 2, why are we developing transmission rates? It's really to identify wholesale transmission rates that are consistent with FERC methodologies that we would apply to ourselves as well as others who might wish to utilize the district's transmission system. Slide 3, the district is generally exempt from FERC's rate jurisdiction, but following these FERC methodologies aligns with industry standard. It aligns with what most large public power companies are doing or have already done. And really, it provides an approach that's consistent with the Federal Power Act, Section 211A, which gives FERC some authority over district transmission rates in that should someone, a third party, bring a complaint against the district about our transmission rates and how we apply those, in that case, FERC would have jurisdiction. Next slide. Existing transmission customers, we have a number of those. We would consider those customers to be grandfathered as part of this process and that these new rates would not apply. There's a list of those customers down at the bottom of the slide and when their current transmission contracts expire. The grandfathered contracts, mostly, not all of them, utilize what you might be familiar with, the SLAN transmission system revenue requirement. That revenue requirement and the FERC methodology are generally analogous for a couple of the rate schedules, but it is interesting to note that the FERC methodology produces a gross revenue requirement that's about 8.4% higher than our current CTSRR methodology. The transmission rate methodology that we've developed, again, we've been working on this quite a while, is consistent with the FERC cost of service study methods. The rates are derived from actual costs in the previous year based on FERC accounting methods. And we would plan to refresh those rates annually, generally July 1 through the end of June every year, which is what we're doing currently with the SLAN transmission service revenue requirement. The transmission rates, it's interesting to note that those are demand-based rates. Typically, we're pretty used to looking at rates that are energy-based rates. The reason we use demand-based rates on the transmission rates is really that the system is designed and built to support expected maximum need, which is a demand number. And that by using the demand-based rates, we ensure that the investment is fully recovered and is really the industry standard for transmission rates. There's a table at the bottom. bottom of the slide that really shows how we stack up the rate that's been developed compared to our neighbors in the area. Kind of a just a high-level background or review of how the rates are developed to determine this annual revenue requirement, and then subtract out revenue credits. We divide by the transmission system use, which currently is the distribution load and the amount of reserved capacity that power marketing utilizes for sales. We end up with a dollar per megawatt transmission rate. So the numbers that go into those gross revenue requirements, things you would expect to see, transmission O&M, an allocated share of A&G costs, depreciation, taxes. There is an investment return, which is the rate base times this rate of return, which includes both the cost of debt and a return on equity component consistent with FERC methodologies for public utilities. Then we subtract out revenue credits that come from those grandfathered contracts. So to put some numbers to some of these rates, this is what the 2019 actuals were that would be used for the 2020-2021 rate determination or rates that we would charge. Those numbers added to the where we come up with the gross revenue requirement of $24 million, subtract out those revenue credits from grandfathered contracts, divide by transmission use of a little over 1,000 megawatts, and come up with that transmission rate of $13,540 per megawatt year. So next steps, like I mentioned at the beginning, we would propose to bring back a resolution for your approval July 6th, and it would be the rate sheets that are attached as part of the commission packet. It'd be what we're looking to approve. I would note on this slide that August 1, 2020 date is different than what went out in your board packet, which had a 1-1-21 date on it. After some more internal discussion Friday, really think moving forward on August 1st is the way to go. So really, like I say, looking to come back July 6th to adopt these rates. Questions?
Commissioners, any questions for Chet? Thanks, Chet. I guess there's no questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, commissioners, we will see you on that item at the next board meeting on transmission rates. Next up, we want to talk about something that we've been working on for a long time and was a big part of our strategic plan, and that's a proposal to improve electric distribution system reliability. Recall that we talked about the fact that we've had a number of good years financially and looking for ways to be able to return some of that value to customers, and that we've been looking into this question of what would it take to move into the top quartile, to be clearly in top quartile for performance on reliability for utilities around the country. And so today we bring you a strategic look at what it would require to make that happen. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Chad Rissman.
Commissioners, this is John Stoll, Managing Director of Customer Utilities. Chad Rissman, Director of Asset Management, will take over the bulk of the presentation, but just wanted to introduce it a bit more. As Steve's already touched on the strategic planning effort, interesting, when the strategic plan was formally approved, we really initiated this effort, probably have spent close to a year getting to this point. We've assembled a small team. Chad Rissman was a big part of it. We've had a relatively newer engineer join his team, Harry Thayer. He really helped out TJ Farrell helped us with some benchmarking, so we really took a deep dive into this. As Steve mentioned, no action is requested, although it does set the table or set the stage for future budget presentations when we come back later this year. Next slide. So one of the things we want to go through as part of this package is just a discussion on the reliability metrics that we use. Look back historically on our reliability numbers and our investment levels. Look at some of the cost versus benefit as we've modeled this out into the future, how that stacks up with the benchmarking and what we looked at when trying to achieve a quartile one, some of those choices, and then again a recommendation. Next slide. So we're getting back to the current strategic plan, invest in assets and people, plus seek industry top quartile retail reliability is a key driver in that. You know, we've always got pretty good feedback on our reliability. However, when we did our benchmarking, we realized we've got some room. And again, we'll talk a bit more on what it means to get into the top tier or the quartile one. And again, develop a set of choices to bring back to achieve that higher reliability. With that, I'll turn it over to Chad Risman.
Good morning, Commissioners. How's my audio, Rebecca?
You're good.
So in the next slide here, I wanted to talk just a little bit about the reliability indices. So these indices are defined by IEEE. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, other than to point out what we've been historically using is this ASAI number, which is measured in a percentage. So what percentage of time is your system available? And although it's a good metric, I always found it to be not all that intuitive. When we look through the other indices that are defined by IEEE, we settled on this SAIDI, which stands for System Average Interruption Duration Index. And what that is, it's just it represents in minutes the amount of time your system, your entire system would be down for the equivalent amount of individual outages that occurred over the year. That's a lot. That's a mouthful. But because it's measured in minutes, we're going to talk a little bit later about our current goal, which is 49 minutes. So on average, if the number of outages that occur throughout the year, if you sum those together, they would be equivalent to taking our entire system down for 49 minutes. I feel like that's a number as we talk about benchmarking. Instead of getting in and splitting between 4 nines and 5 nines on the percentage, it just seemed a little bit more intuitive. So we actually started moving, tracking the SAIDI number a little bit closer. The basis for this index is a metric called customer hours out. So the numerator here is customer hours out, where if one customer was out for 1 hour, that would be one customer hour. So those are the metrics that we've modified in our tracking capabilities. We've made a significant number of changes in the way that we track these metrics so that we can monitor and manage both our investments and get a better understanding of how our system is performing based on our investments and where we're investing. Next slide, please.
Chad, can I ask a question?
Please. Okay.
So, just for clarification of my understanding, does that mean if you have 60 customers that are out for 1 minute, is that the equivalent of one customer being out for 60 minutes?
If you have one customer, 60, yes, it would, correct.
Okay, thank you.
Chad, this is Randy. And before you go on, I just have to input this is completely tongue-in-cheek, but that last slide had to be an engineer's dream. With all of the acronyms bunched all together, it was just perfect. I just want you to know that.
So, I had you in mind when I put that slide together. Thank you.
I figured so.
So let's look at our historical investments, which was really the basis for our analysis. How have we been performing and where have we been investing? And what are we getting as a result of that? Because that's the basis for going forward. So we've invested primarily over the last 5 years. And I want to say, too, that outages are fairly sporadic, and we'll have strong days and we'll have not so strong days in terms of the number of outages. So we like to look at averages and we like to look at rolling numbers. So on the screen in this graph is our rolling five. I also put on, we put on this graph here in red, the red dots, what were our actuals for the year. So you can see there's a fair amount of variability from year to year, but we like the rolling years so that we can smooth that out a little bit. So if you look at the rolling five and the sporadic, it's fairly flat, so maybe coming down just a little bit and settling on that 49.3 minutes. So that would be the equivalent of our system being down for 49 minutes. Historically, over that same period, we've invested a total of about $2.3 million directly in and targeting reliability. Annual, that's annual investment. The majority of that went into vegetation management, which is the greatest contributor to the overhead system-related outages. And then in the underground system are the underground cables. They have a life of 25 to 35 years in there somewhere, depending on how they're operated. So their failure rates are fairly high. So we've invested in both of those areas. And over the last 5 years, we've got a current rolling five year of 49 minutes. So our basis here is that's the result. The 49 minutes is a result of that total investment level. So looking into, next slide, please. So if we look into the areas of outages, this pie chart here, we really can split our system into two different parts, as I mentioned before. Our overhead system, and the biggest contributors there are wildlife, so primarily for us are squirrel-related, vegetation, and feeder devices. And when we add those three together, that's 51% of our outage causes with respect to customer hours. And then in the underground system is cables is 14%. So when we put those two together, those four categories represent a total contribution of 65% of our reliability. So that is where we feel like we'll have the greatest bang for buck in investing in those areas. So one other thing I wanted to mention, too, is there's that other category that's fairly big, which is weather at 12%. When vegetation management has an impact on that weather category, so if there's the way that we track and capture our outage statistics and classify an outage cause is if the tree was otherwise healthy, but there was, say, a very high wind or a very high snow load that broke or damaged a rather healthy tree, it actually gets added into the weather. So although we didn't analyze it, we understand that portions of that weather category will be improved based on our vegetation management activities, too.
Hey, Chad, could you give an example of what's a feeder device?
Oh, great question. Thank you. So we've lumped all of our, let's call it pole line hardware, insulators, arrestors, fuses, dead ends, cross arms, the conductor itself. So pretty much anything that's on an overhead pole line that's not the pole itself. So those like material devices. And we have that feeder devices broken out, but when you put them all together, and each individually, they don't make a great contribution until we realize once you add them all together, they do make a pretty good contribution. So when we go and replace a pole, generally these are not refurbished components. They're more of consumables. So when we replace a pole or perform work on the pole, generally all those things get replaced.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Next slide, please, Rebecca. Okay. Oh, we lost some arrows on here. If we advance the slide once, do we get our arrows back? Oh, yeah. Maybe just go through all those so we add the arrows into each one of those. Thank you. Perfect. Okay, there's a lot going on in this slide, so I just want to take a minute to describe this slide. So this is really the basis of our analyses where we developed these bang-for-buck curves. In other words, we're trying to understand, based on our historical investment in each one of these various categories that you saw on the pie chart, what kind of return do we get in reduction of customer hours out? So we developed a bang for buck curve for all the different strategies. So the arrow there points down to the various strategies. Oh, I need to describe the vertical axis here is reliability and customer hours. And then the horizontal axis is the amount of dollars incrementally to invest in above the $2.3 million that we're currently investing. So what we're saying is we're achieving a certain reliability score with our current investment. What we're trying to understand is if we increase that investment level, what would we anticipate to be the return in the reduction in the number of customer hours? So for each one of those pie chart categories or classifications of outages, we developed a curve, which we've got pointing there to the strategy. And so if you follow anywhere along in that curve, says if you invest in X dollars, that should return within that category a certain level of reduction in the number of customers out. So what we did is we summed all of those individual strategies together and came up with an aggregate. And that is the green curve. So the exponentially shaped green curve there that on the right side is, says aggregate reliability bang for buck that Rebecca's pointing there, the pointer. The green curve there is the aggregate of all those strategies that were in that pie chart. So then we, now that we had this curve developed, and we had an understanding of a relationship of cost to benefits, return, and reliability, our next question was, okay, where would it make sense for us to, what level to invest in? So there's a study that was performed in 2004 by Lawrence Berkeley Laboratories that estimated the impact, financial impact to customers when the power went out. So we took that study and we developed a curve, and that's the straight line curve, which is this customer benefit. So the concept here is if we were able to reduce the number of outages to our customers based on the Berkeley study, in a sense, then, based on the Berkeley study, we would be able to save those customers money, or they would not be impacted financially based on that study. So we put that curve on there. We understood that that would help guide us in maybe what would be an appropriate level. And what we found is that when we cross that benefit curve with the investment and return curve, the green curve and the orange curve, there's a balance point in there. So what that means is at that point is if we invest a dollar in one of our reliability or in one of these outage categories, in theory based on the Berkeley study, we should be able to return a dollar in savings back to our customer. We thought that was an interesting concept, and it is an interesting balance point. So that's the basis of the curve and the basis of our forecast of what our returns would be. And we started converging in on a recommendation. You can see that that balance point for additional investments is at just right about $2 million. So we thought that was an interesting point. And then the next question that we asked, which is in the next slide, okay, if we invest that $2 million and we understand that that's going to generate a return in customer hours, how does that compare with other utilities? And where will we be in this quartiling concept? So a lot of work went into looking at various databases. Thank you to TJ Farrow on all the work that she did on this. There's a lot of different databases out there. And one of the things that we had found is even though IEEE defines how you calculate these various indices, the practices that different utilities are using to collect, govern, and make sure there's consistency within the data itself, there was a significant amount of variability. So this ended up being quite an effort. But I want to highlight two areas that we looked at is the Federal Energy Information Admin has a database of utility reliability information, and most utilities across the country report to that. And there was quite a bit of variability in the numbers. One of the things guided by Steve Wright is we wanted to get a sample of utilities not just in the Northwest but across the United States to see how we would compare across the country. And so these two databases kind of came to the top. The other one is American Public Power Association has this program they refer to as RP3. And it's a reliability program. And there's a lot of governance checking in and processes and procedures that are defined. And APPA is reviewing the data and monitoring the data. We felt like that database, that they call it eTracker database of reliability statistics for the reporting utilities, is probably the most governed. We also felt like in looking at the stats that the utilities that were participating in that database in that RP3 program were likely the more reliable utilities, let's say. And so we really liked that database over the federal database. But you can see there was a significant difference in the SAIDI top quartile number based on these different databases. So 53 minutes for the Federal Energy Admin, which currently Chelan PUD is at 49. So according to that database, we would be in our close to top quartile. So when you compared us against the APPA database, which we understand is more reliable utilities are reporting to, it was much lower at 13 minutes. So we felt like the 13 minutes would be more of a stretch goal, and we liked the RP3 governance that was around that database. So one of the recommendations here is that we target that 13 minutes and change our goal from 49 minutes to 13 minutes to reach top quartile compared to that APPA database. Next slide. So a little bit more on those investment strategies when we break those down, going to the question that we asked. So just going from left to right here, the two biggest categories we feel like we have the greatest bang for buck is the vegetation management. And this is just higher volume, doing more trimming on a more frequent cycle. And then our underground cable replacement. Are those two areas, one in the overhead system, one in the underground system. And then the other two categories that we felt like had some bang for buck, but not quite as much as the vegetation and cable replacement, were animal mitigations. We see a lot of great returns, especially from our wildlife group and our biologists to help us understand where we can target specific areas. We've had some pretty good returns for some fairly low cost. And then the last category here is replacing some of the pole line hardware devices. So the recommendation here is to achieve the 13 minutes and the And in order to achieve that and also hit that balance point for the greatest customer return, sort of converges in on an additional annual investment of $2 million split amongst those categories. So next slide. So we wanted to put on a graphic what this might look like and really setting up some choices. So although we've got a recommendation and we've got this sort of balance point or sweet spot for customer returns, the ability to achieve a targeted reliability is possible with these curves that have been developed. So when we look at two different investment levels, we start off at the 49.3 where the black meets the green and red line there and then converges. The red line shows we feel like we won't immediately be able to achieve that level of reliability. Programs will take a while to both stand up and to take effect. So we feel like we'll, over a five-year period, we would slowly be bringing our annually, we would be bringing our reliability down for these two different investment levels. So what we have forecasted in the budget for 2020 is the red line. So even with what we have budgeted, which is an increase of $500,000, we feel like we would be reducing our SAIDI minutes down to just under 30 minutes. But the $2 million dollars in addition to what we're spending now for a total of 2.3, over a five-year period, we should be able to achieve that first quartile APPA number of 13 minutes. Next slide. And last slide. So just in summary, here are our recommendations. This year, we changed from that ASAI percentage index to the SAIDI minutes index, and we currently have a goal of 49 minutes. We're recommending moving away from that goal and using the APPA database to set that goal and to understand what the first quartile reliability numbers would be. It would be at the 13 minutes. To increase cable and vegetation management by an additional $2 million for a total annual expenditure of $4.3 million. Now, there's other moving parts that, there's a lot of moving parts with our investments. We achieve reliability improvements in other areas and other activities when we're replacing poles, when we're doing other things. We understand that, but not sure how to incorporate that into more of our simplistic view going forward. So it's going to be very important for us to make sure that we're monitoring the annual goal and understanding that we are actually achieving the results that we anticipated. Since we've changed around our data collection methodologies, we will be able to monitor our investment levels and what we're receiving in a return. So just again, we'll be bringing through the annual budgeting process these recommendations. And so we just wanted to provide some background information on how we arrived at some of these recommendations. So with that, I will open it up for any questions.
Commissioners, do we have any questions?
Gary, this is Randy.
Yes, Randy.
First of all, Chad, that was a great presentation. I want you to know that. For my fellow commissioners, you may or may not remember last November, I came back from a education institute on the energy or the electricity world, and I announced to the commission that in the practice.
That's good input, and I do remember your comments when you came back from that work group. Anyone else have a question for Chad?
Commissioners, this is Steve. I'd like to just add one comment. I think this is important. I think We've had some good years, we said, and this is an opportunity to get back some of the value that's been created into reliability. The work that was done in translating the LBL study into something that helps to guide us, I think, was really creative and a great job by Chad and by Hardy as they work through how do we understand what customers want and translate that into how much money we should be spending in order to give them what they want. The one thing I would say about that is that study is old. And one of the things that I've witnessed during my career is that there is an increasing desire on the part of the public to have better reliability. People are doing more and more stuff where they are operating digitally and the interruptions that occur to them have a bigger impact than they used to have. So my guess is that what we will see through time is if we want to achieve top quartile, that top quartile is going to keep moving on us, and it's going to keep moving into a lower number. And so getting started now and moving in that direction, I think, is important in terms of achieving the high level of customer satisfaction that we've established as goals for this utility. So I think this is entirely consistent with the board's direction about the importance of customer satisfaction, and would recommend that we go down this path.
Thank you for that, Steve. Commissioners, any other comments? Well, hearing additional comments, thanks, Chad. Thanks, John.
Thank you very much.
Commissioners, we're at a point where we need to make a choice. We have one more presentation. I'm guessing it is somewhere between a 5 to 10 minute presentation. It's about 5 minutes after 12. I know there has been an interest on the part of the board of going to more like 30-minute lunch sessions. I think my suggestion would be if we wanted to do that, that we might go ahead and get this last presentation done and then be able to move into the afternoon session as was originally planned.
Commissioners, would that be acceptable?
I have a particular set of needs I need to take care of, and a half hour is not quite enough.
Okay. Well, if this were, Steve, if you think this presentation might take only 5 or so minutes, I think it would still leave us with 50 minutes or maybe 45 at the minimum minutes. Would that be enough, Dennis?
Yeah, we'll see. I may just need to step out now and then come back into the discussion.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, no, that would be okay. That would be fine. Anyone else, any other commissioner want to chime in on whether we proceed with this presentation?
Gary, this is Ann.
Yes.
I think I was the one that suggested last week that we shorten our lunch time to 30 minutes, but then I started thinking about it. We have Steve and we have Eric and we have a number of people who are at the at headquarters at work, and no Gerald's open, so that doesn't give you guys enough time to go find lunch. So I was only thinking about myself. Maybe we need to think that through.
I had a brief conversation. Steve, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, Commissioner Arso did talk to me about this earlier, and I probably didn't do enough consultation with Eric and Rebecca on this, so let me just check in with them. I had said that, at least from my perspective, 30 minutes was fine. So, Rebecca, are you okay with that? She says yes. Eric?
Yeah, I have reserves.
So we're okay with a shorter time limit. But I do think that Commissioner Bowles' concern is important to take into account. So maybe if we can go ahead with this presentation, we would just go back and come back at 1 o'clock.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. Everyone agree?
I can do that.
Yes. You bet.
Yes.
And Gary, okay. This is Steve. I dropped my phone and my equipment, my laptop, everything as Chad was finishing up. So I'm back on. I was able to, you probably heard me say all kinds of interesting words. But,
is that you?
I don't know what you were hearing or what was going on. It all went flying, so I'm back.
Thanks. Thank you. So let's go ahead, Steve. We'll knock this one out of the park, and then we'll break and come back after that at 1 o'clock.
Okay, so next up is a low-income program design plan. So there is no decision. We're just going to describe to you how we're going to go about designing a low-income program. Josh, given that we don't need a decision, and it's just an overview for the board, if we could keep this presentation relatively short, I'd appreciate it. So I'm turning it over to you.
Okay, great. And you all can hear me just fine?
We can.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you. Well, let's go ahead and start on slide 2 then, to just move along quickly. My name is Josh Mitchell, the Residential Energy Advisor, and the objective for today is just to follow up on the low-income needs assessment presentation that was given back in March. Today is not directly related to the COVID-19 pandemic work that's been occurring. We plan to walk through the framework of the program design and then provide a schedule of when those components are expected to be completed. Next slide. So on the right, I provided an image that may jog your memory from that needs assessment. What we learned was that approximately 2,000 customers met the state's definition of high energy burden customers, or customers who spend more than 6% of their annual salary on their energy bill. From this needs assessment, we gathered insight on the types of homes, the general geographic location, as well as demographic information. And then the next step was to come back to share a program design plan with you and receive feedback from the board. Next slide. So before we share the drafted framework, I want to remind everyone of the objectives of this program, which are to support the district's strategic plan, specifically to review the low-income energy efficiency programs and assure that there are mitigation alternatives for low-income customers who could be negatively impacted by change in rate design and rate increases. And then also we wanted to work towards achieving the state of Washington's Clean Energy Transformation Act's goals of reducing Chelan County's high energy burden customers, which is section 12 of the plan. So we intend to do this by developing a low income conservation program targeted at high burdened energy customers with high impact measures. Next slide. This is the overall design template. I'm actually going to not go into detail because of the overall plan, but it's something that was set up following a federal guideline plan back in 2011 with ARRA funding, and I just plan to use this design to develop this program. So let's go to the next slide. So where we're at, we've done the needs assessment, program evaluation, we've looked at the data, and we're currently doing the stakeholder engagement. And that's happening right now. We're working with my supervisor, Andrew Grassell, and being supported by Empower DataWorks and whoever we hire to replace Susan Gillen. And then we're doing this engagement to ensure that this program aligns with the district's goals. And then as we meet with community organizations like the Community Action Council, Upper Valley Mend, Chelan Hope, we want to make sure that what we saw in the needs assessment is what they're seeing with the boots on the ground. And then as we plan our internal kickoff for the design of this program, we'll want to consider who we reach out for or who we reach out to within the district for this kickoff team. Next slide. So after completing the stakeholder engagement, we move on to the economics of this. We have the data that shows us the typical user home types that are considered high energy burden, and now we'll need to run some measures into Jim White's economic model to find out if these measures will be cost effective to the district or not. So we then look at budgets for the next couple years, consider potential pilot projects, for example, like installation of smart thermostats for baseboard heaters. And then as we go through this playbook, we may get feedback from stakeholders that says we may want to consider public power benefit funding to make this more economical to the district. Next slide. So now that we've created the measures that have high impact on most of the homes that could use these, now we need to develop a marketing plan. How can we reach these high energy burden customers? What are the messaging and channels that we intend to use? Are we working with our community partners? The intent will be to have a thorough communication plan and schedule developed. Next slide. So after the marketing, we begin the implementation planning, and this design should be fair, impact all high energy burden customers with high impact measures. So the question to be determined still is, will this be 100% in-house? Will we need to contract some of this? Will we need to develop something that, or we will need to develop something that makes it a no-brainer to participate in this program? Looking at elimination of barriers such as social barriers or communication barriers. And this will be communicated through the marketing plan. Next slide. Throughout each step, we'll be looking at the best practices so that we are not recreating the wheel and looking at utilities that have had success developing low-income programs. And then throughout the delivery process, it'll be important to build in regular evaluations to look at performance and tweak as needed. And then the last part of the framework will be the feedback and iteration phase. And so it'll be important that the design team is responsible for feedback, that is, and we build in an internal and customer feedback loop so that we can tweak these as needed. And then next slide. Go ahead and go to the next slide. There we go. So the program design timeline is where we're at now. So as the gray, we've already completed. Quarter two is the green boxes. Right now we're coming to the board to share the framework and receive feedback. In the next couple of weeks, we'll be setting a kickoff meeting for internal stakeholders. Budget and best practices is happening now, and will be completed in quarter three, which is also when we'll be looking at what measures we'll be offering and developing the marketing plan. And then the last quarter will be delivering or planning the delivery infrastructure and getting ready to roll out a low-income program for Q1 of 2021. And this might seem like a long timeline, but it's really important to provide time to ensure that this is a successful program. Next slide. So the framework is developed. I welcome any feedback now or anytime from the board, as well as our internal and community stakeholders, with the intent to have a program to our customers by 2021. Are there any questions?
Commissioners, any questions?
Gary, this is Ann.
Yes, Ann.
Josh, I don't have a question. I just want to say that's a lot of good work, and I really appreciate all the passion you're putting into it. I know you really care. And I'm going to spend some time and look through it again. And I may call with some questions at that time, but great job. Thank you.
And that's the intent, is to let you guys know that this is a great time to have some feedback opportunities for me. So thanks, Andy.
Commissioners, any other thoughts or questions for Josh? Josh, I just have a question back on your graphic on slide number 3, which showed the county and the burdened households. It's color-coded, which demonstrates probably the largest burden, but that doesn't restrict one of the geographic areas from also sharing in the whatever that conservation relief package might look like, correct?
That's correct, yeah. So that's just showing where the high energy burden concentration is located. But there are customers throughout the county that would fit into this category.
Yeah. Great. Thanks, Josh. Commissioners, if there's no other questions for Josh, we can move forward to break for lunch. Josh, thank you very much. Appreciate your presentation today.
Thanks for your
time. Thank you, Josh.
Commissioners, we have a relatively light agenda in the afternoon, so if you wanted to take somewhere between 45 minutes to an hour to go to 105 to 120, any of that would work. Maybe it might be useful just to hear from Commissioner Bowles as to how much time he would like. Oh, we may have lost him. Well, Commissioner Arsenault, I guess I'm going to turn it back to you then.
Okay. Thank you, Steve. Commissioners, if it's your desire, we can reconvene at 1 o'clock, but I'd like to kind of get a head nod or a vocalization whether or not this works for everyone.
1 o'clock, by the way. Same here.
Ann, I didn't hear your comment.
I absolutely, yes, that works fine.
Okay, and Dennis, I'm assuming you're not on the line. I think he was planning to come back at 1 o'clock anyway. So let's just break now for recess for lunch, and we will begin our business session then at 1 o'clock. Welcome to the June 15th, 2020 business session of the Chelan County PUD Commission meeting. I'd like to thank everyone for calling in and Skyping in this morning. In the spirit of social distancing due to the COVID-19 virus, today's meeting will be conducted by both telephone and Skype. Members of the public that may be on the phone line are encouraged to make comment and ask questions. If you do wish to speak, please state your name and address for the record, and please limit your comments to 3 minutes so that others would have an opportunity. I'll open our phone lines for such comment later in today's session. Commissioners, as we begin our meeting today, we are first faced with a consent agenda. What are your wishes?
Well, this is Randy. I was waiting for somebody else, but I will move approval of the consent agenda, which has been amended to include resolutions number 12 and 13.
All right. Thank you, Randy. So the consent agenda has been modified to include resolutions 12 and 13. Do I have a second?
I'll second.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. Do we have any discussion on the consent agenda? Hearing no discussion on the consent agenda, all those in favor of accepting the consent agenda modified to include number 12 and 13 resolutions, please say aye.
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 Those opposed, say nay. The ayes have it. So now it's time to move on to the regular agenda. Steve, are you there? Would you like to take it over?
I will. So we are going to move to item 14, which is safety investigation recommendations follow-up. Let me just take a moment to say that in the spring of 2019, the board received a in-depth description of the investigative report of the incident that led to the death of Mr. Eddie Bromley. That report dealt with not just the specific circumstances of that incident, but more broadly, set of issues that we felt needed to be addressed, including thinking about the culture of the organization and how we could improve safety overall. We're now more than a year since that report has come in. We had committed that we would get back to the board with the implementation of those recommendations. Today's report is to do that. I can tell you that all of the recommendations were tracked assiduously, led by Kirk Hudson, and he'll be part of the presentation today. But there were a lot of different things where there were a number of different folks who were involved, and so this report today will engage a number of our key employees who led different parts of the effort. I believe at this point I'm going to be turning this over to Tracy Yunt, and who is our interim director for safety and HPI. And Tracy, I'll let you lead off here.
All right, thanks, Steve. Can you all hear me okay?
We can.
Okay, great. Yes. So again, it's Tracy Yunt, interim director of safety and HPI, and I also served as the accident investigation coordinator. So Rebecca is going to keep control of the slides for us as we go through this, so you can go ahead and head to the next slide. So the team on the phone today will provide an update on the action items that were developed as a result of the accident and that claim the life of Eddie Bromley. No action is requested today, and this is for information only. A great deal of work has been done and completed to learn everything we can from the events leading up to and including June 13, 2018, and there is more to learn. Efforts include original investigation, detailed actions to implement report recommendations, an additional independent survey, and action items that we'll cover today as well. Slide three, please. So this list right here is a summary, and it represents all the recommendations from the original initial report. The team today is going to cover all of these items in more detail, except two bolded items that are part of longer-term efforts. The first bolded item has to do with working foremen, and we no longer have working foremen operate cranes so that they're part of the overwatch and the coordination effort, but working foremen in other situations is under review, and so that's ongoing. The other bolded item at the bottom is a recommendation by the consultant team to consider elimination altogether of the swing rails. And that consideration, that analysis, has been incorporated into the spillway modernization project. So again, this is the full list. We're going to get into some more detail, and Kirk is now going to kick us off with a little background and describe a little bit what's going on.
Good afternoon. This is Kirk Hudson, Managing Director of Generation and Transmission. And the table that's on your screen is a summary of each of the recommendations from the accident investigation report. It's very high level. What I wanted to provide was context around those recommendations and how they're being tracked. Since the accident report was completed, there's been a team that's been working on this, and you'll hear from most of them today, following myself here, and as well as including Tim Pettit, who was working on this also during the time he was here. But this team has been looking at each one of these recommendations in great detail. This one-line description here doesn't really do it justice. We have a tracking spreadsheet that has multiple parts to each one of these recommendations. And in the status, when you see whether it's ongoing or complete, That is not delineated as complete unless each one of the items that we're tracking underneath that recommendation is completed. So the team has been working on a at least monthly basis in going through the recommendations, planning the work that needs to be done, and tracking the follow-up and making sure each of these recommendations is completed to the satisfaction of the recommendations. So with that, I'll go ahead and turn it over to Greg, and what you'll hear is a high-level summary. We just don't have enough time to get into all the details, but just wanted to convey that the details are very important, and what you'll hear here is just a summary. So with that, I'll turn it over to Greg.
Thanks, Kirk. Good afternoon. My name is Greg Smith. I'm the Safety and HPI Manager, and I'm going to talk to you about two of the recommendations that were given by WD Associates and how we as a district completed them. The two recommendations were improvement to our pre-task plans and to hire an independent consultant to survey employees. It should be noted that the recommendation was triggered because during the WD interviews, it was found that important employee information was not being captured. So Lucas Engineering, being the independent survey company, came in and conducted this employee survey with mostly a focus on the awareness, use, and follow-through of the safety concerns. These next five slides will provide details on how we completed the recommendations. Next slide, please. Lucas Engineering, when they did the survey, discovered three key issues that needed to be addressed. One, which was called the latent safety concerns. These were 21 employee safety concerns that had not been addressed. We found that employees had information and for some reason was not getting captured. So we dug deep into those 21 concerns this last several months, and I'm pleased to say that 19 of the 21 have been resolved or completed, with two being completed later this year. Number two, it was found there needed to be specific ownership for safety concerns and solutions. In the previous time, safety actually gave the solution and then followed the process all the way to the end of its completion. And that was very cumbersome. So that we restructured our internal software, our PeopleSoft, to where safety now just owns the solution while operations owns its implementation. And lastly, employees were uncertain that safety concerns that they were submitting were not being viewed or completed. Now, all safety concerns and completions are being communicated at the monthly safety meetings. We believe this provides the assurance to all employees that their feedback and engagement are much, much valued. So that wraps up the Lucas three key issues found in the independent survey. I'll go to the next slide. Another WD recommendation was the improvement to the pre-task plans. So there were four categories that were outlined for improvement. Effectiveness, identifying hazards, the consistency, and measurement. The first improvement was the effectiveness of the pre-task plan. In other words, how do we know it when we see it? So we created a table. This table you'll see here on the screen that shows a glossary of components that should be present for every pre-test plan. This table is not only used for a guide in conducting pre-test plans, but it actually helps supervisors coach and teach the crews as well by following this chart. In my mind, this really hits on the importance of everyone moving towards operational excellence and as a unified team. Next slide, please. The second improvement was the identification of known hazards. This was actually a real delicate piece to the pre-test plan because we knew not every crew had identical hazards and risks, and the scope work varied from each department. So the safety team drafted and implemented a standardized pre-test plan for the crews to use, and for the next couple of months, they attended these pre-test plans and collected feedback during this time. This allowed the crew members to have a voice and really take ownership in creating the pre-task plan as subject matter experts. So as a result, We ended up getting 12 unique department pre-test plans that were specific to the work being conducted and the hazards associated with them. Next slide, please. The third improvement was the consistency part. This piece of the pre-test plan emphasizes the importance of a consistent discussion. So we used the acronym SPEAK, which helps encourage conversation and creates dialogue amongst the crew. The SPEAK acronym, which stands for S as in summarize critical steps. So what must be sure? What, in other words, once we initiate the action, we cannot go back. P for prior performance. This is are things that have gone wrong or well with similar work in the past. Error likely situations, this is E we're talking about, error likely situations, what aspect of the job could unexpectedly change. A for anticipating worst case, what's the worst case scenario for the job we are doing. And K, kind of defenses, you know, what barriers, policies, or improvements can we put in place to protect our employees. What's important here is that the crews actually will reference the hazards in the previous slide where we talked about what their scope of work was and what their hazards were to the scope of work. They will actually dovetail that into this sheet here and to make it a real thorough and effective pre-test plan. So it really helps the discussion to navigate the consistency in the conversation with the crews. Next slide, please. And the fourth and final improvement was regarding pre-test plans in measuring them. Currently, the safety team attends these pre-test plans weekly. There, they coach the crews, they gather feedback, observe behaviors, and then witness conversations. And we capture all this in a journal, which allows us to measure the pre-test plans. And this is really good because we gather ideas and solutions from the employees for like constant improvement and pre-task plan modifications. So this pre-task plan becomes a working document, a living document, always trying to improve based on the feedback, which is really important. So this concludes the four improvements to the pre-task plan, which were recommendations from WD. Next is Tony Nelson. Tony?
Thanks, Greg. Hello, my name's Tony Nelson. I'm the director of our central maintenance group, and I'm going to review two standards today, the crane standards and planning standards. So the first is a crane standard. Perfect. Thank you. The recommendation and our goal were to standardize all training and qualification requirements for crane operations. So partnering with safety and our hydromechanic crane subject matter experts, we developed a district standard. The standard defined training requirements to include certification and qualifications. The standard also included definitions to our lift zones. We defined each zone, fall zone, work zone, and safe zone. So this helped us understand, identify, and incorporate each zone into our crane PTPs or pre-task plans, as Greg mentioned earlier. The standard is a two-step program. Step one is a national certification. So this training and testing includes the review of our district standard along with roles and responsibilities during crane operations. Step two is the qualification. So individuals go into the field and they demonstrate knowledge and operational understanding and proficiency for each crane operated throughout the districts. We have 18 different types of bridge cranes and 10 different types of mobile cranes. And this was a large task. I'd like to thank our hydromechanics and our CM superintendents. That team was instrumental in developing and implementing our crane standards. Next slide, please. The second standard I'd like to review is job planning. The recommendation and our goal was to develop and implement job planning requirements and standards to ensure that formal job planning is performed for all critical jobs. The generation team worked with an HPI consultant to incorporate our important aspects of planning and develop a risk complexity metrics. As you can see, we use four categories: risk, high risk, complex task, high risk, simple task, low risk, complex task, and low risk, simple task. This gave us a consistent tool to help determine what level of planning is required and responsibilities depending on risk and complexity. The planning metrics, along with our HPI principles, will be used to review all of our critical jobs. Our current plan was to start training in April and May, but was delayed by the COVID-19. So our new plan is to begin training the end of this month with all associated work groups. Thank you, and I'll now turn it over to Dan Garrison.
Thank you, Tony. This is Dan Garrison, Director of Hydro Operations. I believe that it's imperative that I share with the board that we are making sure that the fatal accident of June 13th, 2018 never happens again. To this end, all of the recommendations designed to prevent this type of accident on the Rock Island Spillway are complete. And as others in this presentation have discussed and will discuss, we must apply these painful lessons to all other areas of the district. The Rock Island Spillway specific recommendations fall into one of two general categories. The first is to keep all non-essential personnel out of potential fall zones during spillgate lifting operations. And second, to modify our gate hoisting structures so that the swing rail cannot be lifted from its supports and fall. This first slide shows example installations of warning signs and strobe lights installed at the Rock Island Spillway and designed to keep non-essential personnel out of potential harm. Almost immediately after the accident, we developed standards and procedures to ensure that non-essential personnel stay off the spill deck during operation. Part of that standard is to establish safe zones, one at each end of the spillway and one at the very center of the spillway near the middle fishway. Those areas, employees and other personnel can go to as soon as they're notified of spill gate operations. Once there, the operators provide a radio announcement to ensure that no other personnel enter the general area, that the spill gates will be in operation. That is followed shortly by the activation of warning lights. You can see an example of that in the first left slide. Right beneath the stop here sign is a LED warning light that flashes as soon as the operator activates that light. If in the event personnel are on the spillway or have moved into it unknowingly, they will see a strobe light. You see in the right, small strobe light associated with each spill gate, and those activate if that particular gate is in operation and notifies any personnel in an area that they need to leave immediately and go to the nearest safe zone. After spillway operations have ceased, the all clear symbol or sign is given across the radio by the operators and people may enter the deck again. Next slide, please. The other main category was to ensure that the swing rail could not be lifted and fall. On the left slide, there is a joint installation of a gusset plate and a limit switch. It is slightly darker gray in color. We have installed two devices that will make sure that that swing rail will not lift and fall. The first is a limit switch. And if the rail should be lifted for any reason, it will contact that limit switch within about a quarter to a half inch of movement, and it will interrupt the power to the main hoist on the gantry crane. If the limit switch should fail, we also have a structural gusset plate that that is designed to withhold the lifting strength of the hoist, and again, not allow that rail to lift and fall in harm's way. We have also performed inspections of all rail alignments, everything above the deck, and we will continue to do rail inspections for all the spillways that have swing rails that are currently underwater, and we are scheduled to complete those at roughly 2 gates per year. And with that, I'll turn it over to Darren.
So, hi, my name is Darren Nelson. I'm the Contractor Safety Program Manager and a part of the Safety HPI team. Next slide, please. So what you see here is a roadmap. It's simply a graphical representation of the things that we're working on in 2020. If you start at the bottom of the page and follow the road around, the first 5 stops are elements that we believe are now foundational to some of the successes we realized last year and that we want to continue as we move forward. And those are our principles and concepts, the stop work authority that Steve gave to the district and all contractors to be able to stop work if they see things that they felt were unsafe. What Greg talked about, building on our pre-task plans, and then the GM forums and board presentations, we're encouraging our workers when they implement parts of human performance or different work practices, we want to celebrate those, and we give them an avenue to present during the GM forums as well as to the commissioners, to the board, so we can really see how our employees are embracing the principles of human performance. So starting in the middle of the page where the car is, the next 5 elements are things that we are working on this year, first being learning teams. In January of 2020 BC, which I call before Corona, we trained 10 district employees to become learning team facilitators. Only 4 of those employees are from the Safety HPI group. We reached out into the district to find people that we thought could facilitate a learning team in a non-threatening, in a very logical manner to get the best results, and we put them through a 2-day training. We did our first learning team in January at Rock Island. Luminant Energy actually provided us a facilitator so that we can watch the process and learn at the same time, and that ended with great results. We have a goal of doing 6 learning teams in 2020, and one of those learning teams, we are making a goal that it is not in a craft-related environment. We want to find an office environment that we can learn from as well. The next element you'll come to is identifying our external HPI support, furthering our existing relationships with Lucas Engineering, Luminant Energy, Wes Havrid, and a new relationship with Practicing Perfection. We wanted to also establish more human performance subject matter experts. Greg and myself are in the final stages of completing a certification course with Practicing Perfection that will allow us to have additional tools, philosophies, and concepts to continue making advancements in human performance as we work towards operational excellence. Second to last is exploring a pilot opportunity with Practicing Perfection. In January of this year, we embarked on a pilot program. Currently, 6 work groups within the district, water, wastewater, fleet, safety, fiber, our procurement group, and the substations are now starting a process with Practicing Perfection. One of the things that they are specifically going to help us do is answer the question, how does it apply to me? Over the last couple years, we've had great feedback that people get the science, that people understand that we all make errors. They like the philosophies and the concepts, but we continually hear, but how does it apply to my job? How do I implement those things? And that's one of the things that PPI, or Practicing Perfection Institute, is going to help us be able to answer, is how does it apply to me? And it will be primarily focused on reducing errors and preventing events. And the last thing is introduction of additional tools. We know that tools are powerful and effective, but they're most effective when we know how, when, and why to use them. And one of the tools that we hope, or one of the tools that we will introduce this year will be specifically for that office environment worker, so that we can answer those great questions of how does it apply to me? How can I make less errors in my job if I'm not out in the field? So these are the things that we're working on in 2020 that we know and believe will help craft our HPI strategy plan moving 2021 and beyond. So Tracy, I'll turn it back over to you.
All right, thanks, Darren. So that concludes our update and insight into the path forward for HPI implementation. We wanted to reiterate our commitment to continue to be curious, learn, and improve, and wanted to pause and see if anybody had any questions or comments.
Commissioners, this is an opportunity for any of us to might have a comment to come forward.
I think, this is Dennis, I think two things. One, this is well done, and thank you. And secondly, in each one of your voices, I could hear the earnestness of this process and the fact that this process is being embedded as a part of our well-being. And for that sincerity, I'm very appreciative, and thank you very much.
I guess I would jump in and say that from such a tragic event that we have taken steps moving forward that, as you stated earlier, to prevent something like this from ever happening again, there was definitely lessons learned. And it's with heartfelt sorrow that I congratulate all of you, actually, on a job well done, the time well spent, and thank you. Thank you all very much.
Commissioner Arsenault?
Yes.
Yeah, this is Kirk. I just can't help. I'm looking at the plaque on the screen and just thought I'd ask if it'd be appropriate for a moment of silence to remember Eddie.
Absolutely. Yes, please.
Please join me in a moment of silence to remember Eddie. Thank you.
Thank you, Kirk.
Commissioners, it's Steve Wright. I'd like to just conclude with this thought that hopefully you got a sense from Dan Garrison's presentation that the work that was necessary to prevent that specific event reoccurring was completed a long time ago. We've been at that very quickly. The larger look of contributing factors is something that I think we actually never finish. We've got a number of things, number of items that we can check off and say, yes, we got that particular element done, but part of it is a culture change, which we have to commit to continuous improvement. And so I would anticipate that we will continue coming back to you in the future about actions that we're taking to try to improve the safety culture around the district.
Thank you, Steve. And, you know, I would like to just point out that this is an ongoing effort that will never end. And that just like trying to turn around a large ocean liner in the ocean, it takes a lot of effort, a lot of time to get there. And I just want to congratulate staff for approaching this in a very serious manner and getting the job done. And I think all of us have a very heightened awareness of the importance of safety and the safety efforts and not letting your guard down even for a moment. So I just want to thank staff for their efforts.
With that, Commissioners, that's all that we have on that item. I am ready to turn to manager's items if you are ready for that.
Yes, I think so. Unless we want to open the phones, I don't know if there's anyone who has any comments, any public that might want to say anything. This would be an opportunity. I remind you, please state your name and address for the record and limit your comments to 3 minutes if there's anyone that would like to speak. Hearing no comment, Steve, you're free to move on to manager items.
Okay, first up, we committed to the board that we would provide regular updates on COVID-19 activities, in particular how it's impacting residential and commercial customers. Carrie Wendell comes back to us today to provide that an update to her last update.
Thank you, Steve. Good afternoon, Commissioners. Carrie Wendell, Customer Relations Manager. Today, as Steve said, I'm here to give you an update on the customer impacts that we're seeing from COVID-19. And the information is based on numbers as of June 8th this week, or last week. So if we look at slide number two. From this slide here, we've updated it a little bit. As you can see at the top, it's initial unemployment applications. So as of June 6th, there were 326 new initial applications for that week. So I know last meeting there were some questions on that being cumulative or not, so just updated that slide. So anyone have any questions on that one regarding the unemployment application?
Okay, that's good. Thank you.
Okay. So we'll move to slide three. So this slide here showed the customers that have self-reported since March 16th. And from our last meeting, from May 26th until June 8th, there's only been an increase of 9 customers that have contacted us, 9 residential customers. No new payment arrangements. And we have about 163 now cumulative for the customers who have received energy assistance through Community Action. And then one of the main points that commissioners wanted to see were if these were customers that typically are late or if this was new to them. So just an update on that based on our internal PUD credit score. Again, that's based on late notices, any phone calls that we've made to them regarding payment or NSF checks, or if they've been disconnected for non-pay, that is what makes that change in their credit rating. So we have about 200, out of those 200 residential customers, 87 of them have a rating above 700, so they haven't had late notices or phone calls. And then 113 of them are the more typically late, over 700 for their residential. And then businesses the same. We've got 24 that are not normally late, and then we have about 15 that are typically late. So does anyone have any questions on that?
Yeah, Carrie, refresh my memory. That 87 residential count with a credit score above 700, has that been fairly consistent number?
Yeah, it's definitely been the lower number from the residential customers, the lower number of credit rating, yes, with a higher credit rating.
What I'm saying is has it been running at about 87 of those customers all this time?
So let me look at the last meeting. The last update, there was 78.
78, okay.
Mm-hmm. But 113, those were the same.
Yes.
Yeah. And the same for the commercial customers as well. That number was 25.
And these are customers that when you reach out to them and talk to them, they have verified that they've been affected by COVID in one way or another.
Well, these customers here have actually contacted us.
Okay.
They've self-reported and let us know that their businesses are closed or they have not been working. So they have contacted us.
Okay. And so the point is it's been verified that COVID's the culprit.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So if we move to the next slide. So when you look at the revenue past due over 65 days, it looks on this one, the residential and commercial are very close. So the amounts appear to be the same in arrears, but just for your information, the greater percentage of those balances now are over 90 days old compared to the over 60 days. The way that we keep track of that through accounting is we look at the 60 to 90 day bucket, and then there's a 90 to 120 day bucket. And normally when they're in that 60 days past due, that's when we follow through with our credit and collection processes. So these numbers appear to be the same, but the amount outstanding is just longer compared to the normal 60-day bucket. Anybody have any questions on that?
Okay, I'm going to jump in again. This is Gary.
Okay.
And one of my concerns is that as that past due arrears bucket gets larger, when the time comes to make payment, it's going to be an unattainable number. And so I don't know what that number is, and I don't know how big these numbers are getting. Is that something that you could provide us with as an idea as to, you know, we know they're past due, but how big is the number getting?
I can work on that. Sure.
Thank you.
One other piece of that, Commissioner, is that we're in the process of going back to the furthest amounts that are past due, the customers that we really have not had a response from since March, you know, going back the farthest dates. And we're going to start making some contact with those customers as well as the landlords just to see if the customers are still there or if, if we can work out some arrangements with them. So we're in the process now of figuring out our next steps on how we're going to start trying to communicate with some of those customers. So it's definitely in the works, and we're not ignoring it, but, you know, we need to slowly move into how we're going to work with those customers.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So if we move to the next slide, there are, as you can see from the disconnect notice numbers, those numbers are low, still lower than, this was just up to June 8th, so we'll have more data on this for the next meeting. And this slide, again, is based on the customers that have not reported to us. So these are just the past due amounts that are showing up in our system that we do not have, that are not affected by COVID. So there's 307 accounts that are past due as of June 8th. And again, based on their credit score, where there's 277 residential accounts that are past due and then 30 commercial accounts that are past due. So similar, all the similar credit scores match similar to the last update. If there's any questions on that slide, we can move to the next one. Thank you, Rebecca. So these are the totals for May. We helped 39 customers with a total of $7,459 that were paid out through Helping Hands. And the contributions for the 3 months is up to $7,700 at this point. So really, in summary, you know, we'll continue to work with these customers on the balances and continue to make payment arrangements and referring them to community action as we do. And, you know, we're not seeing, customers are, we're working with everyone, and so there hasn't really been a big impact for our group at this time. Are there any other questions?
Commissioners, any questions for Kerry? I guess not. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you.
Okay. Next up, commissioners, we want to give you an update on the 4th of July celebration at Walla Walla Park. Ryan Baker is going to provide that presentation.
Thank you, Steve. Good afternoon, commissioners. As Steve mentioned, we wanted to let you know what's happening with the 4th of July celebration this year. Things are still on track. We're hoping for the show to start around 10 p.m. at Walla Walla Point Park. Modifications are in place to address the current restrictions with social gatherings. Communication will start early, probably as early as next week, with some press releases, some signage, social media, and some radio ads as well. Walla Walla Point Park will remain open to the public until 6 p.m. on July 4th. The park will actually be closed to pedestrian traffic starting at 6 p.m. And this will include a closure of the Apple Capitol Loop Trail beginning at 6 as well. No vehicle traffic will be allowed in Walla Walla Point Park on the 4th. The main entrance gates will be closed at 10 p.m. on July 3rd. Alternative park locations to Linden Tree, Riverfront, and other South area parks will remain open at this time. No one other than law enforcement, security, or the pyrotechnic team will be allowed at Walla Walla Point Park for the event. Unfortunately, there will be no vendors or others allowed to enter the park or other planned activities during the 4th. Folks are encouraged to social distance and watch the show from both Chelan and Douglas counties. Event organizers have indicated that the shells are actually bigger this year so that folks can see them at a greater distance. I wanted to take this time to thank those that have been involved with coordinating this event. Monthly meetings happen. A lot of folks are involved, including local law enforcement and Symphony and others out there. So they're very excited to still bring this show to our customers. And I would welcome any questions that you might have at this time.
Commissioners, any questions on the 4th of July event? I guess not. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate that. I'm looking forward to the festivities.
You bet. Have a great day.
You too. Thanks.
Next up, commissioners, want to invite John Stoll to give you an update on the customer satisfaction survey, which will be going out soon.
Good afternoon, commissioners. Yes, as you know, on the balance scorecard, we had this set up for about first quarter of this year, but with the situation, we put it on hold. At this point in time, we're ready to move forward. I believe you've seen the questions. This year, it's fairly brief. I believe our Consultant Strategies 360, it's about an 8 to 10 minute survey. Traditional questions, I think probably the only new thing is just understanding about communication with some of the technology we're putting in place for the future. So I believe about midweek they will start doing field work, anticipate that being complete by the end of June, and then maybe July, early August, they would be back for the report out. So that's pretty much it in a nutshell. Happy to answer any questions. Neil in communications has really done a lot of the legwork, so I've appreciated his support. But again, if you have any questions, let us know.
Thanks, John. Any other questions, commissioners? Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Okay, next up, you know that we have been working for quite some time on Rock Island Powerhouse 2 rehabilitation project. Some really good progress has been made there. John Seigerser will be describing that to you, as well as some upcoming events that will require the board to be involved. John?
Thanks, Steve. Good afternoon, commissioners. This is John Seigerser. I'm the Rock Island EPM department manager and also the program manager for Rock Island Powerhouse 2. So I just wanted to let you know that I am having some technical difficulties, so I'm not able to see your slides, but Rebecca will be driving for me. So if I'm off kilter a little bit, just don't hesitate to let me know. Next. So we're here today just to give you a little bit of an update, kind of where we've been, what we've been working on, how it all fits together, and what do we have planned next. Next. So I just wanted to remind you, you may remember that we met with you back in March, early March, prior to sending out a notification to our most qualified design builder. I think it's important to note that we did not receive any protests related to this particular design-build award, which is significant because it is our first design-build procurement process that we've participated in. Next. So we've been working mainly on what we call the design-build agreement, or the DBA, and it is almost complete. This is the foundation document, or really the umbrella document, that covers over all the other documents that we will put together for this related contract or work. It does contain all the terms and conditions for the entire project for the duration expected to be around 10 years. And these terms will not change with the design of the turbines and the generators. So this includes risk transfer items such as indemnity, limitation of liability, correction of work, claims, and a mutual waiver of consequential damages. The design-build agreement also contains our pre-construction services agreement. It's really an exhibit to the particular document. And this is what commits the district to the design portion of the design-build work. It's really about $4.5 million, and we're expecting it to complete in early December. We've also been working on the technical specifications. They will be included with the design build agreement as exhibits, similar to the pre-construction services document. We will have some documents that will be executed with the design build agreement. These are things that kind of dictate how we work together, things like coordination and meetings, standards, and other such documents that will really kind of govern the design process. The rest of them will be developed as part of the pre-construction services. These will be things such as, you know, turbine rehabilitation, generator rehabilitation, cooling systems, and other systems along those lines. Next. We've just started working on documents around the extended warranty. We've put a framework in place so far and are working to negotiate that. From that framework, contractual documents will be developed and executed as an exhibit to the design-build agreement. And we'd really expect to execute that exhibit prior to doing any unit work or anything that would be covered under the extended warranty. What's next, really, is what we call GMP, or Guaranteed Maximum Price Amendments. And these will be developed as part of the pre-construction services work that's going on. We really expect to have one GMP amendment per unit, although we may have some other GMP amendments to cover things such as mobilization,
any new structures or warehouses or shops that they may need to build to support the work, early release of specific components, and different things along those lines. The GMP amendments are, again, as I said, specific really to each unit, and they will they sit under the umbrella agreement, so all the terms and conditions and everything associated with those big agreements govern what's happened on the GMP amendments. But they will have other specific things, such as the particular scope, the schedule, the budget, liquidated damages, everything along those lines, which could be different from unit to unit. In general, we're estimating that each GMP amendment or each unit GMP amendment will commit the district to about 1 to 2 years worth of work and about $25 million. Next. This is really just a visual trying to give you an idea of how all these documents fit together. As I mentioned, we have the design build agreement, which is really the overarching or umbrella document that governs all of the work that we anticipate to do as a part of this contract. Pre-construction services, which is really the design portion, fits and becomes a part of that umbrella as an exhibit, as does the extended warranty and the technical specifications. And then the GMP amendment or all the unit work or the build portion of the design build project really comes in and fits in under those umbrella documents. Next. So as Steve said, we are hoping to get some information to you in early July. We expect to have the design build agreement ready, draft resolution for information to you in July. With a resolution for your action in either late July or early August. And again, that would be executing the design build agreement and the exhibit for pre-construction services only. We expect the extended warranty and really the first unit GMP amendment to be ready around the end of this year or early next year. And with that, I'll open it up to any questions that you may have.
Commissioners, any questions for John? Thank you, John. I appreciate the presentation. I have a more clear understanding.
Good. I'm glad. It can be complicated. There's a lot of parts and pieces to this one.
Well, there are a lot of moving parts. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks.
Yep. Bye.
Bye.
Okay. Next up, commissioners, a bit of a bittersweet moment. I want to invite Kim Craig to come on up. Although you can't see her, she's going to be sitting. She can sit right up here and so that hopefully she can say a few words too. This is Kim's last board meeting after 21 years at the district and a mainstay here in the boardroom. Been here for every board meeting for an awfully long time. And, of course, she's also been the person who has translated your great thoughts into something on paper that could actually be read by the public and that they can follow along on what we're doing. If you don't know, oops, Commissioner Smith has poked his head in just to wave goodbye to Kim. Kim has always been enthusiastic and positive and a team builder and looking for ways to be able to make sure that we are fully transparent in what's going on here in the boardroom, and we really appreciate everything she's done in that regard. We're going to miss her. And so we want to take a moment just to say goodbye, although not completely goodbye. At least I know I hope I'll continue to see her on the trail where I get to see her pretty regularly these days. So. Kim, congratulations on a terrific career here at the PUD, and turn it over to you.
Well, thank you very much. I just want to say hello to the commissioners and anyone else who might be listening today, and just to let you know that I'm really here to share my profound gratitude with all of you, to our senior managers, all of my coworkers because I had the amazing opportunity and weighty responsibility of telling the district stories. It's true that 21 years went by in a blink. I am walking out of here with some pretty amazing experiences. I learned that every power pole has a belly button. I've got to be involved in the Lineman Rodeo. I have stood on a spillway pier at Rock Island Dam with hundreds of thousands of CFS of the Columbia River rushing past. I've gotten to gear up to climb down into a Rocky Reach unit and stand at the bottom of the Columbia River and look up at the water dribbling through those intake gates, hoping that all systems are working as they should. No one will hit the button. And I've been in a bucket 90 feet above ground for a bird's eye view of transmission work. And it's all been a wondrous and deeply satisfying second act in my career. It was my great honor to serve the people of Chelan County and to serve with all of our committed, amazingly skilled employees. And I thank you.
Okay, commissioners, who's going to go before me?
You go ahead and go, Garrett. Go ahead and go to somebody because I've got to compose myself.
Right. Okay. Go ahead, Randy.
And Kim, I don't even know where to begin to share with you the energy and desire to do the right thing and to show us as we truly are, which I think is in a very good light over your career. This commissioner will really miss you, but I have to share with you, and we're not going to get an opportunity to do any roasting, I don't think, anytime soon. My enduring moment of remembering you was not at the PUD. It was actually at the Town Toyota Center at the Chicago concert. Need I say more?
Yes, thank you for bringing back that good memory.
All right, very good. So, anyway, you're really going to be missed by this commission.
Thank you very much.
This is Steve McKenna, and Kim, I've told you many times that as the new guy on the block, you saved my bacon many times going to preparing for the radio station interviews. And as a superintendent, I was, I used to interviews in a subject that I was well versed in, but as a PUD commissioner to come in and visit with the people in the radio and the public on air on a completely new world to me, your assurance and knowledge and particularly your assurance was so heartfelt by me and so appreciated. And you did such a great job. And I just wanted to let you know how much I appreciate you.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Still do.
Kim, this is Ann Condon. I just want to say you have been lovely to work with. Yes, you would very nicely and respectfully correct us when we made mistakes, or at least for me, maybe I'm the only one, on our radio interviews. You were always very kind about it. Just lovely to work with, and I'll miss you.
Thank you, Ann.
Okay, Kimberly, I'm going to give it a try. Our relationship goes back a long way when you were at the Natchi World and husband Nick was at the Natchi World, and then your movement to the Chelan County PUD and my opportunity 14 years ago to join you in this organization. The other day, I went into the office to do a bunch of signatures on forms, and one of them happened to be a retirement form. And it just completely caught me off guard because I was hoping you wouldn't make that decision someday. But congratulations on having made it. And your contributions have been wonderful. Your personal friendship and support has been really appreciated over time. There is a personal quality about you that is just sincere with a great amount of integrity, and your professionalism has always had the highest level of journalism. And in this day and age, in many areas, journalism has slipped, I think, and has fallen a bit from grace, whereas you have always made that effort to uphold the standards of journalism and represent the PUD fairly and fully in the eyes of the public that own it. And I'd just like to say congratulations on your retirement. Gonna miss you. And thanks for all you've done. Take care.
Oh, thank you very much, Commissioner.
So, Kim, it's Gary, and I, much like Dennis, when I came into the office last week to sign some papers and I saw your name on the retirement form, I was taken aback. Let me tell you, first of all, I'm a big believer in retirement. I think it's great, and you're going to have a great time with it. But when you have quality folks like yourself, and your departure will definitely leave a gap. And so while I wish you the well, for selfish reasons, I wish you were sticking around too. So I have to say that, as maybe not the newest or first most recent elected commissioner, but certainly new enough to know that I've gone through similar to what Commissioner McKenna was talking about, coming into an industry where I might be able to know quite a bit about finance, but when it comes to, you know, hydro projects, I was pretty green behind the ear. And getting the opportunity to talk to the public, I can just tell you that your guiding hand was very comforting during those very stressful interviews. I think it was said earlier, and I want to echo it, you take the words coming from my mouth and somehow turn them into a really nice, very legible comment. And I appreciate that. I know what it is I'm trying to say, but let's just say you put the shine on it, and I do appreciate that very much. So you will dearly be missed, but have a great time in retirement.
Well, thank you very much, Commissioners. It's been a great honor. I appreciate it.
And, Kim, I'm not allowed to give you a handshake, but I do have a plaque for you. Okay, sorry, Commissioners, we were doing the presentation of the plaque and have completed that now. So we are done at this point with manager's items.
Hey, Steve, I've got a question.
Uh-huh.
You were giving Kim the plaque. Who was taking the picture?
Neil and Rebecca. So we actually got a couple of them.
That's good, because I just got thinking, she's the one that always takes the picture. Who's taking the picture today? Well, thank you.
Yeah. Eric's suggesting we'll use the security camera in the future, so find a way to put that to use. We're up to commissioners' items.
All right. Commissioners, do we have any discussion items?
So, Gary, I'll follow you after you give the report on the board meeting last week, if there's anything that I think I would like to have, but you're our board rep. But before I do that, a couple of weeks ago, Steve Wright and I were in a conversation about our track down technology road.
And I made a comment to him that he indicated would really be good for our billing department people or our technology people would be good for them to hear, because the comment I made to him had to do with we've got one mobile app from our utility right now. It has to do with lake level, and we're just starting down this path. And I told Steve, I said, you know, here locally, I actually told him I had one app that I just dearly loved, and it's from Cashmere Valley Bank, and it's on my iPad. And I said, I will consider the PUD a complete success if they can emulate what I experienced on Cashmere Valley Bank, and that actually it's now the Wenatchee World also. That's complete facial recognition, and you enter your password once and you can forget it for the rest of your life. I just absolutely love that. So, I mean, that's a standard that to look for, in my estimation, on our technology as we move forward. So I'm hoping John Stoll is listening and others in a variety of areas of utility. Technology excites me, especially when it works for me rather than to me. So that's my commissioner moment until later.
Thank you, Randy.
Randy, this is John. Duly noted. Thank you.
Do we have any other commissioner comments or good for the order?
Just a comment, Gary. I need to apologize. I was online as we broke for lunch. Somehow I got muted by someone else and couldn't get back in. I could hear all the discussion, but I couldn't respond and I couldn't get rid of it. And Rebecca, as usual, put up with my grouchiness today and got me back online, and I appreciate it, but thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome. I know we were having trouble with our cell phone here earlier today. I guess T-Mobile and some of the cell services were down. I don't know if that had any impact on what you were experiencing or not, Dennis.
Don't know, but it was frustrating.
So I would like to talk just a little bit about, I've got two things I'd like to discuss. One is last week's WPUDA meeting, where we had a discussion on Governor Inslee's incursion into PUD's domain and authorities. And just to summarize it, what I would say is that the feeling amongst the PUDs that were on the phone were quite strong, some stronger than others, but uniformly the decision was made that WPUDA would deliver a letter to the governor's office opposing his incursion into those authorities that had been previously granted to PUDs. It was a good meeting, but as I say, there were several representatives from PUDs whose fuse was relatively short and would eagerly take the next step if the governor doesn't reconsider. So that was one item. The second item I would like to share with each of you some information. I am on a council. It's called the Recovery Council. Its focus is COVID-19. While the sponsor of the committee is the chamber, it is focused on the entire county, not just Wenatchee. There's been effort. This committee, I should say, has been meeting for some time now with efforts focused on reopening the county, and there's been a number of letters that have been drafted and efforts been taken to try to get us to phase two and then obviously the ultimate goal, phase three. Part of the effort has been delivered. There's been a delivery and a purchase made by the county to purchase masks for shop owners, storekeepers, and this is primarily the smaller shop owners, you know, the Home Depots and the Costcos, they're going to buy masks for their employees on their own nickel. So the county has gone forward. They purchased masks. They are in the process of delivering those to the shopkeepers throughout the county. The Recovery Council is really focusing on, as I said, looking towards phase three. What's going to get us to phase three? And, you know, we feel on the committee that education is something that really strongly needs to be pursued. And that when I say education, it would be things about the importance of washing your hands, the importance of distancing. And I will also mention to you that one of the members on this committee is Dr. Stu Fried from the hospital, Barry Kling from the health district, and even community leaders like Greg Oakes, president of Casimir Valley Bank, is on this committee. So at this last meeting that I was attending last Thursday, the conversation revolved around, well, it's not going to do a whole lot of good if just the storekeeper's employees are wearing a mask. What about the customers coming in the into the store? And so, again, as I said, there's two phases to this, two legs on this stool. One was education, washing hands, and this would be achieved through mailing. So this would be achieved through public broadcasting on our local Channel 12 broadcast station, TV station, also newspaper ads, that type of thing. But back to the masks. So the idea was really to emulate a Costco-type model where you go to Costco and as a shopper, you come in the store, you're asked to wear a mask. Now, understanding, again, the focus here is going to be the smaller shop owners, those that really can't afford to purchase and procure that size of a quantity. And, of course, this committee, our Recovery Council, we're not suggesting that everyone would impose a requirement to wear a mask. We're simply suggesting that people will be given the opportunity that if you wish to wear a mask, there would be one made available to you when you come into the store. So having said all of this and listening to comments, Casimir Valley Bank and Greg Oakes has committed some dollars to help procure some masks. And the idea would be that it would be a matching dollar program. So the light bulb went off over my head. And I was thinking, well, we have public power dollars that perhaps this might be a good use to support the community and the county in delivering these dollars for the purchase of educational material. As I said, newspaper ads, maybe some TV spots on the local television station, and some direct mail, as well as perhaps being used to purchase some masks that could be distributed to shop owners so that they could make them available to customers coming into their shop. Again, the end game here and the end focus of this committee is what's it going to take to get us to phase three? And so having said all of that, what I would make a request to my fellow commissioners is that we provide a token of $25,000 to make it available for educational purposes and COVID-19, as well as the purchase of some masks, which would be delivered to shop owners to give to their customers if that customer were to choose to wear the mask when they came in the store. And that this would be funded through our public power dollar program. And I'm anxious to hear any feedback.
Gary Dennis, I think it's a great idea. $25,000 put back into the community to help move us toward level three, I think, is the wise investment of those dollars to our, because everyone in Chelan County is one of our customers. And if we can help our businesses get back on their feet and get the economy locally in better shape, $25,000 would be a minimal contribution, and I'd be happy to support that.
Thank you, Dennis.
Dennis, was that a motion?
Well, it could be, Randy, but it was just a point of
discussion. You've got a second.
It could transform itself.
Well, Gary, you've got my complete support in that. For all the reasons that Dennis just articulated, I think we ought to do that. And this is one of those cases where it doesn't require the soak time. And besides that, with moving to phase 1.5 to 2.5 or whatever, time is of the essence. So if Dennis's was a motion, I will second his motion.
Dennis, can we interpret that as a motion?
Yes, you may. And good luck trying to figure out how to word my wordiness.
Do we need a motion?
Sorry?
Do we need a motion?
We don't need... Commissioners, this is Eric. Technically, you don't probably need that motion under the Public Power Benefit Program at this point, but I'm okay with you making the motion. I do want to say that a general motion... approving that contribution would be best. We will have to work through the details to address some of the nexus and gifting issues. For example, we just have to find the right avenue or recipient for those dollars.
And Eric, I have some input that I can help you with on that.
Yes, I figured you might.
Any other discussion?
So, commissioners, how about I would suggest a motion that just would approve a $25,000 contribution toward the COVID. I'm going to call them relief efforts for the purpose of public education en masse for the benefit of the district, its employees, and its customers.
Is that what Dennis said?
I believe it is. Nice quote.
Thank you.
Okay, Eric, I think you can assume that that was the motion that Dennis made and that it was seconded by Randy. And I guess at this point I would call for anyone who has a discussion. This would be the time to discuss it. Hearing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed say nay. The ayes have it. Thank you, everyone. Steve?
Gary, if you're still on commissioner items.
Oh, yes. Go ahead, Randy.
A reminder for everybody, this Wednesday there is a commissioner roundtable, I believe, at 9 a.m., open to all. And one last item that we haven't talked about since it happened that I think is really important that we provide recognition where recognition is due. Our manager, Mr. Wright, at the APPA Virtual Conference received a national award this past week, and I haven't seen it in the Wenatchee world, but maybe it has been there. But I just want to say, Steve, the recognition you received for the Alan Richardson Statesmanship Award was richly, richly deserved for all the work you've done on behalf of not only Chelan, but the entire public power industry in this nation, and thank you very, very much.
Well, thank you, Commissioner Smith, and I want to thank the board because I assume they had a lot to do with the nomination process, and certainly has been a pleasure, an honor to work on behalf of public power, but I particularly appreciate that the board creates room for me to go be involved in a lot of these activities like the climate change task force and some of the hydropower licensing work, et cetera. So thank you to all of you, because without your support, this never could have happened.
Steve, it was well deserved.
Congratulations, Steve.
Thank you all. I think we may be ready for delegation of action items.
Yes.
Got a couple. Let's see. Andrew Gassell had one to get back to you on the translation of the 27 cents per gallon. That is a Chelan PUD rate number. Hopefully you received that. We had a follow-up on the National Electric Safety Code requirement for emergency disconnects, and Kathy Melton did look into that, talked to Commissioner Smith. My understanding, Commissioner Smith, you got what you needed there. Is that correct?
Yes. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. We have a couple more we're still working on. The rendering of the Service Center Plaza fixtures, that just a look at the dams on the Columbia and how that will look. And Carrie Wendell did provide an answer today with respect to those unemployment numbers are a snapshot, not a cumulative effect. So I think that's it for where we stand right now.
Great. And delegation from today?
Yeah, so Rebecca would like me to remind you all that there was one item, but it was not a staff item. It was Commissioner Bowles was going to propose some new language for the board balance scorecard, and that has been done. And we only have one item for today, and that's Carrie Wendell provided a summary of the dollar amounts of past due accounts. How large are those accounts getting to be?
Good. Thank you. Okay. Well, we're back on then to any public comment. Members of the public that might still be on the phone are encouraged to make comments and ask questions if they so desire. I'll open up the phone lines now. If you do wish to speak, please state your name and address for the record, and please be kind enough to limit your comments to 3 minutes. Hearing none, is there any other matters of general business to come before the commission? Hearing none, how long of an executive session will we need today?
30 minutes.
30 minutes, all right. So we are going to go into executive session to discuss with legal counsel agency enforcement action, litigation, potential litigation, to which the district or the board is or is likely to become a party, and or legal risks as authorized by the RCW. And we will do that for 30 minutes. I'm looking at my clock. It says 2:25. You want to just call it 3 o'clock?
Sounds good.
Okay, very good. We will go into executive session. We are coming out of executive session. It is June 15, 2020. No decisions were made. No votes were taken. Is there any additional business to come before the commission? Hearing none, we shall stand adjourned.